Chapter 19. Bringing It All Together. Learners and performers come in all shapes and sizes. Some people are aggressive. Others are cautious. Some of us like questions. Others prefer answers. Some bubble with confidence, always hungering for a challenge, while others break into a sweat at the notion of taking on something new. Most of us are a complicated mix of grays. We have areas of stability, and others in which we are wobbly. In my experience, the greatest of artists and competitors are masters of navigating their own psychologies, playing on their strengths, controlling the tone of battle so that it fits with their personalities. While in this book I've conveyed my vision of a life of learning, it's my hope that you'll take these ideas and make them your own, make them fit with your natural disposition. I have found that in the intricate endeavors of competition, learning, and performance, there's more than one solution to virtually every meaningful problem. We're unique individuals who should put our own flair into everything we do. The question is, how do we do this? Let's say we've become very good at something, and we're capable of performing reliably under pressure. How do we become exceptional? How do we make that leap from technical virtuosity to unique creativity? The real art in learning takes place as we move beyond proficiency, when our work becomes an expression of our essence. This was the challenge at the center of my preparation for the 2004 Chunghwa Cup, the World Championships of Tai Chi Chuan Pushhands. What was it inside that could take me to the top? When I think back on the arc of my competitive Tai Chi life, Taiwan was always the reality check. It was the true measure of my growth. The skill level in U.S. Pushhands events, including our championships, doesn't compare to such competitions in Taiwan, where Pushhands is the national sport. Mediocrity can be self-nurturing, and frankly, many U.S. Pushhands players delude themselves about their level of proficiency. The top Taiwanese fighters train for many hours a day from childhood, constantly competing in brutal regional and national tournaments. For the summer before the biannual Chunghwa Cup, the elite schools have training camps where fighters up the intensity of their preparation, working 6 or 8 hours a day, combining intense conditioning with technical sharpening. The stakes are very high for these competitors, and they're well-oiled machines when they step in the ring. Foreigners traveling to the Chunghwa Cup are entering the den of the lion. Win in Taiwan, and then we can talk about greatness. The first time I traveled to Taiwan, in 2000, I was fresh off winning my first Pushhands National Championship. In more ways than one, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I described in Building Your Trigger how I got blindsided by the scheduling of the event. I was told my first match would be early in the morning, but I was faced with hours of waiting. I got increasingly hungry and had nothing to eat. When the lunch break was announced at noon, I devoured a greasy platter and was immediately called to the ring. I got blown out of the water by the guy who went on to win the tournament. While I certainly needed to take on the psychological side of what happened to have any chance to compete under these conditions, the truth of the matter is that it was not the decisive factor. My opponent was much better than me. If I had been perfectly poised, he would have beaten me. I had a lot to learn. In the 2 years following my first experience in Taiwan, I really buckled down in my training. I've described much of that work in the early chapters of Part 2, but there was also another component to this preparation. Chinese martial arts tend to be very secretive, and Tai Chi Chuan is a particularly enigmatic discipline. If you read the Tai Chi classics, study the philosophical foundation, practice the moving meditation, you'll gain a sense of awareness, feel supple, and possibly be able to generate a lot of speed and power. But it's hard to translate these principles into viable martial application until you test yourself out in the ring and incrementally separate the real from the mythical. Unfortunately, many teachers haven't done this themselves, and they protect their egos and their schools by claiming to have tremendous power, for example, the ability to throw someone without touching them, but they refuse to show anyone. Often, supposedly great martial artists will avoid demonstrating their power by offering the explanation, "If you and I were to spar, I might kill you." Whenever I hear this, I know that I'm listening to a charlatan. True masters have control. On the other hand, some very powerful skills really can be developed, and it's true that the greatest secrets are kept for a very select circle. There is always the lingering question, what is really possible, and what is hype? Until I went to Taiwan, I had no idea what to expect. And sure enough, the top competitors were armed with a skill set I had never dreamed of. They were remarkable athletes who had grown up in a culture that cultivated the refinement of push hands in the same way that the old Soviet Union had mastered the engineering of great chess players. Following that first tournament, I was armed with direct observation and many hours of video of the toughest push hands players in the world. That video footage of the top Taiwanese competitors would prove to be a crucial well of information. After my first trip to Taiwan, I saw that the greatest practitioners were not mystics, but profoundly dedicated martial artists who would refine certain fundamental skills at a tremendously high level. The subtlety of their unbalancing techniques was sometimes mind-boggling. While an untrained eye might have seen nothing, these players were using incredibly potent combinations designed to provoke the tiniest of leans, and then opponents were on the floor. From 2000 to 2002, I studied these tapes in detail and slowly refined my game. During those years, much of my training was with my dear friend Tom Otterness, who was William Chen's senior student and one of the most powerful internal martial artists I've ever known. Tom is a sculptor who spends his days molding clay and who subsequently has hands and arms that feel like a bear's. Add over 35 years of Tai Chi training, and it's no surprise that Tom hits like an avalanche. When Tom and I first started working together, he'd smash me all over the ring. I felt like a tennis ball meeting a wall of force, and to make matters worse, Tom was also a heat-seeking missile. There was no avoiding his power. I was forced to add subtlety to my neutralizations and to build up my root so I could survive his onslaughts. As a reminder, by root, I'm referring to the ability to hold one's ground while directing incoming force down into the floor. You can then channel the force back up from the ground and bounce an opponent away. When a martial artist is described as having a deep root, the parallel is to a tree. It feels as if his or her body is extended into the earth. Working with Tom night after night gave me the confidence that I could stand in the ring with anyone. When I went back to the Chenghua Cup in late November 2002, I was ready, or so I thought. By now I had won the U.S. Nationals for 3 straight years. I regularly competed in multiple weight categories, often giving up over 100 pounds to my opponents and consistently winning heavyweight and super heavyweight titles. I was a much improved martial artist, and I also knew what I was getting myself into. My first match of that 2002 Chenghua Cup was against the Austrian representative, who had just won the European Championship a few months before the Worlds. I described in the previous chapter how early in the match he nailed me with an uppercut to the groin. He was a dirty player who counted on getting into his opponent's heads, but a large part of my training the previous couple of years had been focusing on handling his ilk. I buckled down and knocked him out of the tournament. My next match was against the top student of one of the Taiwanese schools. He was slippery, very fast, but he had a bad habit of rooting off his rear leg when pressured. As I mentioned in The Illusion of the Mystical, the problem with putting your weight too far back is that when it shifts forward, as it must inevitably, there is an opening, a flash when you're vulnerable. I'd been working very hard on my throws for the previous 2 years, and I was able to work him towards the edge of the ring, make him lean on me, and then use his momentum to put him on the ground. His habitual weight distribution served as a tell, and I was all over him. I won the match easily. Now came the semifinals, and my opponent was a Taiwanese star. His name was Chen Zicheng, and he was the guy I had been most impressed with 2 years before. In fact, the video footage I had focused on most closely while preparing for this year's tournament was of Chen Zicheng dismantling his opponents. Chen has the physicality of a gazelle, tall, sinewy, incredibly strong for his weight, and dazzlingly athletic. He puts opponents on the floor with a speed and technical virtuosity that just baffles the mind. He is the son of the top pushhands teacher in Taiwan, who is also arguably the best trainer in the world. And so in addition to his physical gifts, Chen has been receiving the very best instruction since childhood. When the opening bell rang, I was all charged up. Our wrists met in the middle of the ring, and he immediately shot in for a throw, which I crimped. But he kept the pressure on, pummeling in with his hands to get an advantageous grappling position. I felt danger everywhere. I kept on brushing him away from me, staving off throw after throw, but he wouldn't stop coming. His power felt internal, relaxed, molten, and always primed for an explosion. He was all over me, relentless. But he still hadn't scored any points. A little over halfway through the first round, I caught him off balance, in the middle of one of his attacks, and exploded into a huge push that sent him flying. It looked like Chen was going out of the ring, but he landed with his toes still in, heels hovering over the line, and he did a matrix maneuver, head backwards nearly to the floor, while he pushed out with his waist to keep his balance and stay in bounds. Such an athlete. I charged into the attack, but just when I arrived, he was upright again and somehow rooted. This was a war. Playing in that ring with Chen, I had the feeling that he was in my skin, sucking out my energy. I kept on pushing him away like a bad dream. I would unbalance him a little, weather his storms, but his conditioning was amazing, and he kept coming back. With about 30 seconds to go in the round, I started to feel drained. I've come to understand that this is a big part of Chen's strategy. He pressures opponents, nags them. He's looking for openings, but really just goading rivals into exhausting themselves by pushing him away. He keeps pummeling in, getting pushed back, and returning with an endless persistence. I felt this happening, and decided to stay in the clinch for a minute, let him in, see if he could do anything. I was on the floor before I could blink. It was a stunning throw. I was up, and then I was down, and I didn't know what hit me. I got up shaking my head and came back at him. There wasn't much time left, and I was over-aggressive and got taken down again. The second round was more of the same. He pressured me, I staved him off, searched for openings, but for the most part he felt like a martial giant. About a minute into the round he caught me flat-footed, and the next thing I knew I was piling face-first into the mats. Man, was he fast. Then he just held me off, protecting his lead. I went after him, and was in the middle of a wild attack, a desperate attempt to come back, when the bell rang and the match was over. We hugged. He had beaten me with grace and true excellence. My neck and shoulder were throbbing in pain. I was wrecked. I had one more match in the tournament, a fight for third place, which I somehow managed to win despite hardly being able to move the right side of my upper body. So I took bronze in the tournament and had two more years to stew in my juices until my next chance. The bar had been set. After the 2002 World Championships, I was a man on a mission. The time had come to take my game to a new level. I had felt, up close and personal, what the best in the world was all about, and I knew it was within reach. This next phase of my learning process would be about building and refining a competitive repertoire that was uniquely my own. Immediately after coming home to New York City, my work began. The first couple months of training after the world were mostly mental. For one thing, I had to let my body heal. My shoulder was a mess, and it needed some time before it could take full tilt impact. So I studied tapes, broke down the technical repertoires of Chen Zicheng and the other top Taiwanese players. Watching hours of footage frame by frame, I picked up on infinitely subtle setups and plays with footwork that really opened my eyes to what I was up against. The difference between numbers 3 and 1 is mountainous. I would have to become a whole other kind of athlete, step by step. By mid-January, I was back on the mats doing soft training that didn't aggravate the injury, but kept my body fluid. I worked on some new technical ideas, integrated the movements into my arsenal by doing slow motion repetitions. By March, I could mix it up at full speed without worrying about my shoulder. But I still wasn't playing competitively so much as working on the ideas I described in the chapters Making Smaller Circles, Slowing Down Time, and The Illusion of the Mystical. I was still in the research and development stage. I have talked about style, personal taste, being true to your natural disposition. This theme is critical at all stages of the learning process. If you think about the high-end learning principles that I've discussed in this book, they all spring out of the deep, creative plunge into an initially small pool of information. In the early chapters, I described the importance of a chess player laying a solid foundation by studying positions of reduced complexity, endgame, before opening. Then we apply the internalized principles to increasingly complex scenarios. In Making Smaller Circles, we take a single technique, or idea, and practice it until we feel its essence. Then we gradually condense the movements while maintaining their power, until we're left with an extremely potent and nearly invisible arsenal. In Slowing Down Time, we again focus on a select group of techniques and internalize them until the mind perceives them in tremendous detail. After training in this manner, we can see more frames in an equal amount of time, so things feel slowed down. In The Illusion of the Mystical, we use our cultivation of the last two principles to control the intention of the opponent. And again, we do this by zooming in on very small details to which others are completely oblivious. The beautiful thing about this approach to learning is that once we have felt the profound refinement of a skill, no matter how small it may be, we can then use that feeling as a beacon of quality as we expand our focus onto more and more material. Once you know what good feels like, you can zero in on it, search it out regardless of the pursuit. On a large scale, this is how I translated my understanding of chess to the martial arts. On a smaller, more focused scale, this is how I trained for the 2004 World Championships. While this principle of penetrating the macro through the micro is a critical idea in the developmental process, it's also an absolutely pivotal foundation for a great competitor. At the highest levels of any kind of competitive discipline, everyone is great. At this point, The decisive factor is rarely who knows more, but who dictates the tone of the battle. For this reason, almost without exception, champions are specialists whose styles emerge from profound awareness of their unique strengths, and who are exceedingly skilled at guiding the battle in that direction. With this in mind, my training for the 2004 World Championships would have to be built around my core strengths. Sure, I'm a good athlete, but frankly, there'd be many fighters in Taiwan who are more gifted than me physically. Some would be stronger, some would be faster, some would have more endurance. But there would be no other fighter who could keep up with me strategically. To win in the Chunghwa Cup, I would have to bring water to their fire. I wouldn't be successful making the fights a test of speed and acrobatics. I would have to read opponents and shut them down, confront them with strategies and refinements they couldn't imagine. To have any chance in the ring with him, I would have to dictate the tone of battle and make Chen Zicheng play chess with me. I had one good thing going for me. As I described in the end of part 2, my main training partner in my preparations for the tournament was my friend Dan Caulfield. Dan is an incredible natural athlete and a lifetime martial artist. Since childhood, a huge part of Dan's life has been devoted to exploring the outer reaches of his physical potential. As a boy, growing up in rural New Hampshire, he taught himself to jump from higher and higher surfaces until he could comfortably leap off a 30-foot roof, land in a roll, and come up running. If you point to a car, if he's in the mood, Dan will jump over it. If you look at a steep cliff or a brick wall, Dan can figure out how to climb it. If you go hiking with Dan, he leaps from boulder to boulder up the mountain like a goat. Add in over 15 years of Aikido and Tai Chi Chuan training, and you've got yourself a force to be reckoned with. The lucky thing for me was that Dan is built somewhat like Chen Zicheng. He shares Chen's enormous physical talent, and stylistically they are both predators. While both are technically masterful, they also have the tendency to take big risks, believing in their athleticism to help them recover if put into a bad position. This is what I had to build on. To win in Taiwan, I would have to use Chen's greatness against him. In the 2 years before the 2004 Taiwan tournament, Dan and I basically lived on the mats together. Some nights we were drilling techniques, building the power of our throws while the other was just a body, hitting the ground 100 times before switching roles. In other sessions, we were refining footwork, breaking down the precise components of going with momentum when someone has an edge and tries to spin you to the floor or out of the ring. It's amazing how you can land on your feet and balanced if you know how to stay calm and principled, embrace the chaos, while you're spun with the torque that sends sweat hitting walls 10 feet away. But more often than not, Dan and I were duking it out. Night after night, we had brutal sessions, spending hours in the ring squaring off, clashing, neutralizing attacks, exploding onto weaknesses, hitting the ground, getting back up, and colliding again like rams. Dan and I continuously pushed each other to improve. We were both working so hard that if one of us stopped learning, he would get killed in the ring. It was during the last 4 months of our preparation that I came upon my fundamental strategy for the tournament, what chess players call prophylaxis. You see, I believe that Dan, like Chen Zicheng, is a more gifted athlete than me. For all my training, he can do things that boggle my mind. So in working with Dan, I developed a game that was based on squelching his talents. In Taiwan, I would play in the style of Karpov or Petrosian, the grandmasters who triggered my existential crisis at the end of my chess career. In the last months of Taiwan training, instead of trying to blow Dan out of the ring, I tried to shut him down, crimp his game, and use the tiniest overextensions to my advantage. I created an approach we called the Anaconda. I would pressure my opponent, stifle his attacks, slowly inch him out of the ring while cutting off escape paths. If my opponent breathed, I would take space when he exhaled. This was a game that relied on keen presence and sensitivity to my opponent's intention. Every aggressive move in a martial arts confrontation is risky. To attempt the throw, you weaken your structure if only for a flash. I would use that flash. Whenever Dan tried to throw me, I entered the attack, took space, and tried to simultaneously neutralize his aggression and cinch down the pressure. Week after week, I got better at this. I was creating the anti-Chen Zicheng game, and Dan got better at attacking me. Some nights I would dominate him, repress his every attack, and then explode into my own throws when he got desperate. Other nights he would be electric and destroy me. I remember one night in particular when he felt like a jaguar. He was all over me, above me, behind me, on fire with an animal inspiration. I limped home feeling absolutely bereft, but the next night I came in and locked him down. For the final 3 months before Taiwan, I recorded all of Dan's and my training sessions. Then, every night, I would go home and study the tapes. This was valuable on a number of mundane levels. Watching yourself on video, you can spot tells or bad habits. You can refine your techniques by breaking down what works and what doesn't. But the primary function the tapes had for me was very different. Dan and I had both reached such a high level of presence to incoming aggression that our sessions were marked by fewer and fewer points. We knew each other's games. We knew what attacks were coming. We knew how to probe without overextending. Dan had figured out how to play against my right shoulder in a manner that neutralized most of my aggressive impulses, and I could usually take advantage of his attacks to edge him out of the ring. If you took our physical and mental abilities, put them together, and collided them on the mats, we were dead even. We were also performing at peak levels, so few mistakes were being made. We were in a state of dynamic equilibrium. The only times points were scored were in moments of creative inspiration, when one of us did something that transcended our current level of ability. These were the moments I focused on in the videos. Two or three times in an evening, Dan and I would be in the middle of a wild flurry, and suddenly my body would put his body on the ground. Just like that. And two or three times, he would do the same to me. We were playing with such a tight margin that I couldn't think about a technique and then do it to him. No way it would catch him off guard. But a few times, my instincts would find something that my conscious mind didn't pick up on. When I went home and watched the video, I studied each of these moments frame by frame to see what happened. Sometimes I would see myself triggering into a throw just as Dan's blink began. Other times my body would direct a throw off to a creative new angle that caught Dan unawares. Maybe my footwork would fall into rhythm with his in a manner that opened up a tiny gap of momentum to ride, or I might catch him at the beginning of an exhalation. There were many moments like this, each of which I studied until I understood. The next day I would come into training and tell Dan what I discovered. We would then convert what had been creative inspiration into something we understood technically. If my body synced up with his breathing, we broke down how to do this at will. If I caught a blink, we studied the nuances of blinking. Next time we sparred, Dan would be aware of the new weapon I was working with, and so he would create a counter in order to stay in the game. Then I would work against his counter. This way we raised the baseline of our everyday level and incrementally expanded the horizon of what our creative bursts could attain. Let's think about this method in the language of chess. If a chess expert were to have his most inspired day, he would come up with ideas that would blow his mind and the minds of others at his level. But for the master, these inspired creations would be humdrum. They are the everyday, because his knowledge of chess allows him to play this way all the time. While the weaker player might say, "I just had a feeling," the stronger player would shrug and explain the principles behind the inspired move. This is why grandmasters can play speed chess games that weaker masters wouldn't understand in hundreds of hours of study. They have internalized such esoteric patterns and principles that breathtakingly precise decisions are made intuitively. The technical afterthoughts of a truly great one can appear to be divine inspiration to the lesser artist. When I think about creativity, it is always in relation to a foundation. We have our knowledge. It becomes deeply internalized until we can access it without thinking about it. Then we have a leap that uses what we know to go one or two steps further. We make a discovery. Most people stop here and hope they'll become inspired and reach that state of divine insight again. In my mind, this is a missed opportunity. Imagine that you're building a pyramid of knowledge. Every level is constructed of technical information and principles that explain that information and condense it into chunks, as I explained in the chapter Slowing Down Time. Once you've internalized enough information to complete one level of the pyramid, you move on to the next. Say you are 10 or 12 levels in. Then you have a creative burst, like the ones Dan and I had in the ring. In that moment, it's as if you're seeing something that's suspended in the sky just above the top of your pyramid. There is a connection between that discovery and what you know, or else you wouldn't have discovered it. And you can find that connection if you try. The next step is to figure out the technical components of your creation. Figure out what makes the magic tick. The way this process functioned with Dan and me was that my body would somehow put him on the ground. The way I did it was outside both our conceptual schemes, so neither of us really knew what happened. Then I went home and studied the tape. I saw, for example, that my throw triggered from a precise grappling position at the exact moment that Dan's left foot received his weight from his right foot. I didn't do this consciously. My body just did it instinctively. But now we've learned that in that particular position, an opponent is vulnerable when he shifts his weight in that manner. The next step for me is to create techniques that force the switch of weight, and Dan can become more conscious to avoid the trap. We both get better and better at playing around the split second when the weight settles on the ground through the left foot. We've created a body of theory around a fleeting moment of inspiration. Now there are techniques and principles that make this weapon accessible all the time. We have taken our pyramid of knowledge up one level and solidified a higher foundation for new leaps. After 7 or 8 weeks of this work, we had internalized a very tight network of martial arts techniques that were all the products of Dan's and my most inspired moments. This became our championship arsenal. What we constructed was all new, highly personalized, and completely true to our individual strengths. And most of it was psychological. It was about getting in the opponent's head, catching his rhythms, controlling his intention with subtle technical manipulation. When we went to Taiwan, we were ready for war. Chapter 20. Taiwan. 2004 Chunghua Cup. Tai Chi Chuan World Championships. Taipei. December 2nd through 5th, 2004. Clouds moved fast, dark and gray, the rain coming in gusts and then tapering off as Typhoon Nanmadol surged over the South China Sea. I've always loved storms. Now these fierce winds made me electric. It was Thursday evening, 40 hours from battle, and I stood at the peak of Elephant Mountain, looking down on an old Taoist temple, the city of Taipei spread out below. The smell of incense wafted up from the temple shrine, smoke swirling in the building winds. I'd begun preparing for this tournament, the World Championships, the day after losing in the semifinals 2 years before. My last 3 months of training had been brutal, night after night of pain, pushing myself to the absolute limit until nothing was left, and then dragging myself home to rest up for the next day's sessions. Now I stood, breathing deeply, soaking in the wind and rain. The sky to the west was a livid red. It was coming. I felt alive and ready. There are two kinds of push hands in the Chunghua Cup. One is called fixed step. The other is moving step. Together, they make up two divisions in this gigantic international competition that draws thousands of martial artists from more than 50 nations. The events are very different, and most competitors specialize in either one or the other. It was my dream. In truth, it was my ambition to win both. The moving step game is fast, explosive, played in an 18-foot diameter ring. The object is either to put your opponent on the ground or out of the ring. The inner game of moving step is subtle. It requires fine-tuned presence, technical mastery, and quickly evolving strategy. But from the outside, much more apparent is the feral athleticism of the best fighters. It's a physical and mental melee of the highest order. The Taiwan-style fixed step game is much more restrictive. In many ways, it's the truest test of a Tai Chi practitioner, because there's no way to get around the internal principles of the art. There is no room to mask technical weakness with athleticism and fixed step. It is minimal, like haiku. You have two highly trained martial artists engaging in an explosive contest at very close range. There is great potential for injury because of violent clashing and sudden joint manipulation. The game is tight, and the power generated is so condensed that an untrained spectator can often see nothing until one fighter suddenly goes flying away from the other and lands on his back 8 or 10 feet away. Thursday night, about 4 hours after I got back from my blustery hike up Elephant Mountain, I found out that the tournament officials had changed the rules of the competition. Previous years in Taiwan, fixed step had been played on raised pedestals, each fighter standing with his right foot forward, left foot back about 3 feet to allow for a dynamic, rooted stance. In this year's competition, the Taiwanese removed the pedestals without any warning to foreign teams. This apparently small alteration in format would give a crucial advantage to the local teams who've been training under the correct conditions for the previous year. I will come back to the surprise soon, but first, imagine a fixed step competition. The forward feet of the opponents are lined up, heel to toe, about 1 foot apart. Players are very close together, with opposing right wrists crossed and touching, the left hands hanging by the left hips like old Western gunfighters. In this posture, the mental game begins. Players stand still, poised, vying for subtle advantages that will key explosive attacks. This moment is an energetic stare down. Then the ref says go, and play erupts. The first to move a foot loses the point, or if someone is thrown to the ground, 2 points. If a lead ever exceeds 10 points in a round, round over. At first glance, it looks like power and speed are decisive. Whoever is faster getting his hands on the other guy seems to win. But if you break the game down, it becomes apparent that certain techniques refute other techniques. Every attack will get you thrown on the floor if met by the right counter, but moves and combinations of moves come so fast it feels like a guessing game. Martial rock, paper, scissors. This is only the beginning. There is a sea of potential that flows from this opening stance, an almost infinite number of feints, swift attacks from all angles, psychological ploys. In time, with years of creative training and a willingness to invest in loss, to take blow after blow and get blasted off the pedestals as a way of life, the game starts to slow down. You see attacks coming in slow motion and play refutational maneuvers in the blink of an eye. Great players are doing many invisible things in this game. It feels like chess. At the highest level of the sport, you are living inside your opponent's head and directing what he comes at you with. Because each fixed step point begins exactly the same way, with two players assuming an identical opening posture, competitors can plan attacks in advance and over time build repertoires of combinations and defenses that they fire into when the ref sets play in motion, in the same manner that strong chess players have sophisticated opening repertoires. Since the first time I went to Taiwan 4 years earlier, I've been breaking down the game and creating fixed step theory that emerges from the agreed opening posture, standing on pedestals with the set hand positions. Taiwanese officials had sent us the exact dimensions of the pedestals months before this tournament. I had then internalized my arsenal of attacks and neutralizations, and was so comfortable with the game that I often trained with my eyes closed, allowing opponents to trigger first. My body would shrug off the attacks and explode into instinctual counters. All of this training was done while rooting on two small pedestals. Now, one day before the competition begins, the news was that there were no pedestals, and the rear hand would begin on the opponent's elbow instead of by the hip. This is a huge structural change. The equivalent in chess would be for a grandmaster to spend 5 months preparing an opening repertoire for a world championship match, and then, before game one, to discover that the whole repertoire had been disallowed by a mysterious rule change. In a minute, everything had shifted, and we had a handful of hours to recreate an entire repertoire. On one level, this was infuriating. On another, it was predictable. Tai Chi is an emblem of Chinese and Taiwanese greatness. In a way, this discipline represents their sporting and philosophical essence. The top Taiwanese competitors train since childhood, many hours a day. If they win this tournament, they're national heroes. They take home a substantial cash prize and also get full scholarships to university. A career can be made in a day. Foreigners are welcome, but no one wants them to win. The Taiwanese pull up the stops to prevent it. It's a question of national pride. At 1 a.m. Thursday night, Max Chen and I were up exploring the nuances of this new structure. Max is my teacher's son and a very close friend of mine. He has been the U.S. National Sanshou Chinese Kickboxing Champion 3 times and is an accomplished push-hands player. Max knows what it's like to be on the front lines in international competition. We made a plan. Then I lay in bed visualizing until 3 a.m. By Friday morning, it was pouring torrentially. Typhoon Nanmadol was just offshore. I've been through a number of hurricanes on boats in the Bahamas, and something about this type of brooding, ominous buildup in the sky clicks me into a highly efficient place. I was on fire with ideas. We had intended to rest Friday, fill up the tanks, but that wasn't an option anymore with the new rules. The whole team, 10 of us, gathered under a huge gazebo-type structure in the park by Jingchuang Stadium, where the tournament would be held. After living and dying on the mats together for the past year, we were a family, a dedicated unit with utter conviction about our work. And yet from one angle, our situation was completely preposterous. We were gathered outside in a typhoon trying to figure out how to survive without pedestals. Max had spent the morning jogging through the downpour, trying to sweat off 4 pounds before the weigh-in. The wind was howling, and even under the gazebo, rain hit us horizontally. Dan and I worked together, refining new strategies on the fly. While our teammates did some light sparring, we spent 2 hours recreating our fixed-step theory. The key was to roll with the evolving situation and contour new tactics around the principles we had discovered back home. When hit with such surprises, if you have a solid foundation, you should be fine. Tactics come easy, once principles are in the blood. I felt confident. House rules are almost always in effect when playing on the road. I knew this from the chess days and previous Taiwanese debacles. Handling dirty tricks is a part of the game. Day 1. Saturday morning. We arrived at the stadium and weighed in at 7:30 a.m. Everybody hungry, but no eating until we made weight. After all the preparation, there is nothing like that feeling of icy reality that hits when the opening bell is near. At the weigh station, reality sunk in one step deeper when we saw Chen Zicheng and his team, the dominant school in the world. He was the guy who had beaten me 2 years earlier, and whom I'd been preparing for all this time. I walked over and said hello, and Chen told me that he was competing under 75 kilos, 165.3 pounds, the weight division below me. I was shocked. I had spent 2 years dreaming about this great fighter, strategizing against his sinuous cat-quick game. In my mind, winning the world championship had meant defeating Chen Zicheng. But then he pointed toward their guy in my division, and I took a deep breath. They called him Buffalo, and he looked like pure power. In Taiwan, he was considered unbeatable. He'd been groomed to become a world champion since he was a young boy. He was a little shorter than me, and much thicker. He weighed in at 79.96 kilos, 176.3 pounds. I weighed in at 78.16 kilos. He was 4 pounds heavier than me, and probably cut 15 pounds to make weight. The guy was a daunting physical specimen. After the weigh-in, my team and I went and checked out the moving step ring. I felt the traction of the mats, then moved around a little. Immediately, alarm bells were going off. The ring seemed too small. Tournament officials had sent us rules and ring dimensions months ago, a 6-meter diameter circle. We used their precise dimensions to set up our training mats for both fixed and moving. I had internalized the dimensions of the circle and knew exactly how it felt when my heel was a quarter inch from the edge. If you step over the border in moving step, you lose a point. And in the flurries of action, there's no time to look down. Ring sense is hugely important. We measured, and the diameter was 15 inches smaller than what they had sent us. This was the second dirty trick, and the matches hadn't even begun. So we had to adjust. Typical, but there was nothing to be gained by getting worked up about it. We walked to the hotel in the rain, ate a big meal, and came back at 10 a.m., fueled for battle. The fixed and moving competitions would be going on at the same time. Two rings would be used for moving step, three for fixed. Weight divisions were every 5 kilos, with men and women competing separately. Over 4,000 competitors from all over the world were milling around, and the stadium was mobbed with fans, many of them chanting euphonically in languages I didn't understand. It was a great, lilting, hypnotic sound. Acres away, on the far side of the arena, balletic Tai Chi form competition was taking place. Blood and meditation were coexisting. My first match would be moving step. The rules, simply put, are as follows. Play begins from contact. This is a grappling competition, like wrestling or judo, so striking is supposedly not encouraged. The target area is from the waist to just below the neck. You cannot lock your hands behind someone's back or grab their clothes. Otherwise, play is wide open. You gain 1 point for throwing the guy out of the ring, 2 points for a clean throw, where the opponent hits the floor and you're standing, 1 point for a throw where you go down on top of the opponent. Matches are 3 rounds, 2 minutes playing time each. If someone leads by 4 points in a round, it's over. 2 out of 3 rounds wins, and if rounds and points are even by the end of 3 rounds, the lighter guy wins. That rarely happens, but if the Buffalo and I stayed healthy and managed to make it into the last round, it could give me a tiny edge. My first moving step opponent was strong, fast, and aggressive. His speed surprised me, a very good athlete. All the players from the top Taiwanese schools have a way of putting the cardio load on the opponent and draining him with subtle pressure and leverage. They have excellent pummeling techniques, which means they know how to take inside position with their forward arm in the clinch. Imagine an opponent's left foot forward, left arm deep under my armpit, and wrapped around my back or up my shoulder. That is an underhook. Pummeling is the fight for that position. The inside arm tends to give more leverage and slightly better angles for throws. If a player has double inside position, it means that he has underhooks on both sides. This is considered to be very advantageous in all grappling arts. If you ever hear martial artists talking about a pummeling war, they don't mean that two people are clobbering one another, but that they're fighting for the underhooks. It turns out that pummeling would be a huge component of my tournament strategy. You may recall that I hurt my right shoulder fighting Chen Zicheng in the semifinals of the 2002 World Championships. Since then, the shoulder has been my Achilles heel. About 3 months before this year's Taiwan tournament, the 2004 Worlds, Dan came upon an interesting method in training. Whenever I had the right side underhook in the clinch, He would clamp down on my elbow from the outside in a manner that just killed my shoulder. After weeks of pain, I decided to concede the pummeling war and take double outside position in training to avoid damaging the shoulder any further. While I initially felt at a disadvantage giving Dan the underhooks, over time I became increasingly comfortable. I came up with some subtle ways to crimp his leverage, and I found that I could make the angles work for me. In my final 10 weeks of preparation, when training with anyone other than Dan, I felt completely dominant from the outside position. My weakness had blossomed into a weapon that would prove critical for me in Taiwan. You see, the Taiwanese are lightning quick with their pummeling, and I made the decision early in the tournament not to fight it. Don't play their game. By giving them that first position they were so used to fighting for, I mitigated a large part of their training, the pummeling war. Then we would do battle in the setup I had become expert in, and that they hadn't studied as deeply. This happens all the time in chess at the highest levels. Top players discover hidden resources in opening positions that had been considered theoretically weak. They become masters of a forgotten or undiscovered battleground, and then guide opponents into the briar patch. So my first opponent was very aggressive, but nothing he brought felt dangerous. His pummeling was excellent, and he came at me with tremendous confidence. But once I locked down on him from the outside, his structure felt a little unsound, like a grand house with a flawed foundation. I knew that if I weathered his early attacks, I'd be fine. I crimped his attempts to use the underhooks and edged him out of the ring a couple times. I went up 2 points in round one and just held the lead. Then I watched the buffalo. Wow. First he blew the other fighter out of the ring. Then, lightning quick, he trapped both the opponent's arms under his left armpit, took the guy's back and flipped him over a deep leg. He manhandled the guy and looked unbeatable. At one point after a throw, it looked like he would fall, but he somehow did a full split, caught himself with heel and toe, and just popped back up, getting the full 2 points. This was my man. I had to find a weakness, but didn't see it. My next match was fixed step. Not much problem, except for the judges. Many points that I won, the scorekeeper didn't record. This was infuriating, but also hilarious. Imagine, the referee would signal that I won the point, but the scorekeeper would neglect to write it down, as if he'd forgotten or hadn't noticed. This happened again and again. My teammates and father were screaming about it, but nothing was done, except that officials would nod to them with placid smiles. It happened to every foreigner in the tournament, sometimes decisively. This was the way they kept score here, their country. Nothing to do but score more points and keep the static out of my head. Against most guys, the judges couldn't really hurt me, but in the final rounds, where we were evenly matched, there would be little margin for error. I tried not to think about it. Whenever I had a break, I watched the buffalo. He won his points easily. He had fine technique, but he also was much more powerful than his opponents. He could blast most guys right out of the ring in a flurry of explosive aggression. But I started to sense some small vulnerability. Maybe. He was technically sharp, with dazzling footwork, speed, and a deeply rooted stance. But something about his structure teased me. In my next fixed step match, I faced off with the top guy from the school from Tainan that is the main rival to Chen Zicheng's team. They are fierce competitors, like soldiers, strong, fast, well-trained, pure aggression. All signs pointed to a war, but we touched hands and I knew I had him. You can read a lot about a martial artist from the opening contact. Great ones feel mountainous, like the earth is moving inside of them. Others ring more hollow. He bounced right off me on the first couple points. Then I started mixing things up, and he couldn't keep up with the tactics I threw at him. I won the first 2 rounds by a big margin. No injuries. Match over. I watched the buffalo compete again in fixed, and he was overwhelming against a lesser opponent. But I had this building feeling that there was something a little wrong with his foundation. He was so physically gifted that it was easy to stand gaping as he tossed the guy to the floor left and right. But he seemed to be covering something up with all the flash. I wasn't sure why or how, but in fixed he felt mortal. In moving step, he seemed unstoppable. Day one was over, and I wasn't injured. This is a long tournament, a marathon of sprints. Almost all of these martial arts competitions last only one day, because players' bodies usually break down after that. You can push through virtually anything in 8 or 10 hours, but then the injuries burrow in overnight, and you can't walk or lift your arms in the morning. This tournament is 2 days. You have to win on Saturday without getting badly hurt to have a chance to become world champion on Sunday. I went to bed listening to the rain outside my window, and I dreamed about the buffalo. Day 2. Sunday morning, 8 a.m. We arrived at the stadium in time for an unhappy surprise. The Taiwanese officials had created a separate tournament for foreigners and scheduled to run it before the championship rounds. I was informed that participation was mandatory. I asked whether this could take place after the main event and was told that it was impossible. This absurd tournament within the tournament clearly had the function of exhausting and injuring foreigners who were still competing for medals against the Taiwanese in the championship. A time-consuming protest ensued, with a tremendous language barrier eventually being bridged by my teacher, who fortunately had some weight. It was agreed, finally, that those of us who were still in the main competition could take part after our final matches. I had 2 fights left in each division to win. First was Moving semifinals, against the number 1 fighter from the tough Tainan school. Moving was his specialty, and he came right at me, elbows tight in the pummeling, fast, persistent, putting the cardio load on me. He attacked early and I circled out but stepped on the line. My instincts were off. I thought I was well in bounds but was wrong. On our mats at home I would have been in. Bad move. Down 1-0. We went back at it. I let him push me to the edge of the ring, baiting him, and exploded into a reversal that put him inches from the line, but he had a deep root and wouldn't go out. Then I switched gears and went on the offensive, pressuring him, using the anaconda technique I had developed 3 months earlier, inching him out, surging, tightening the noose whenever he tried to squirm away, clamping down when he exhaled. In the final seconds, I caught him with a beautiful throw, but my shoulder got jammed on the landing. I was on my back between rounds, breathing hard. This may have had a telling psychological effect. In preparation the last few months, we did a lot of interval training, building sprint time in the ring and working on recovery. We would play 1-minute rounds with 1-minute breaks between, sometimes going 15 or 20 rounds like that, 4 of us playing, alternating play and recovery. My idea was to be able to have a wild sprint, drain myself completely, and know that I could come back in the next round even if I felt like death baked over. Interestingly, months before the competition, the organizers told us that there would be 30 seconds between rounds, and we found out upon arriving in Taiwan that it was 1 minute. So I had been doing this 1-minute interval work with the team, largely as a training mechanism to work on going all out without overextending, and also to condense recovery time. Now we showed up, and there were 1-minute breaks between rounds. Their switch played right into our hands. I knew I could spend every last drop if I had to, and then I would be back and okay 60 seconds later, if I lay on my back, breathing deeply. I looked like a dead man between rounds, but was fine. Round 2. He shot right in at the bell. I held him off, gave him the underhooks, locked down, cranked right, left, he went with it. But then I caught him on the 3rd try, spun him out of the ring and onto the floor. These guys are great technicians, and I really figured out how to shut them down. By just giving them that first position they were so used to fighting for, I created a new battlefield. There was no resistance where they expected it, and then much more where they were less prepared. Amazing how it all started with an old shoulder injury. I was in his head and up 2-0. He looked confused. Then the confusion turned to desperation, and he charged me, putting everything he had into one last attack, torquing wildly, out of control. I went with the force, landed on my feet, and used the momentum to toss him out of the ring and onto the floor. Round and match were mine. I watched the Buffalo annihilate another opponent. Just him and me in moving step for the title. I still didn't see a weakness in his game, but I had a plan. There were 45 minutes before my fixed step semis, and I had a rough time. My shoulder hurt so badly I couldn't lift my right arm up past my waist. I was all banged up, black eye, forehead 1 big rug burn, pain all through me. The shoulder had me concerned. Dan and I were the only guys on our team left in the main draw, and we sprawled on the mats while teammates massaged our legs, shoulders, arms. I put on my hood, sat in a corner, and hoped my body could hold out for 3 more matches. Then it didn't matter. They called me up for fixed step semis, and it took a lot to walk over to the ring. My opponent was somebody I'd been watching throughout the tournament. In his 40s, barrel-chested, serene, and powerful. The man had the feeling of a samurai. He was older than almost all the competitors, the only guy his age still in the competition. I had watched him dispense with younger, athletic opponents left and right, and he clearly had amazing skill. What I didn't know is that he was one of the most respected teachers in the world. The stadium was loaded with his students. I heard chanting, and knew it wasn't for me. Round 1. Our wrists connected, and before the first point began, he was working on me, taking space in that strange internal way some of these rare ones can. The ref said, go! I attacked fast, met empty space, and flew into it. Down 1-0. This guy had the stuff. The magic, if there were magic in the martial arts. Next point, I bounced off him. Powerful root. I couldn't attack him. I tried a lateral technique and won a point. He blasted me once and then pulled me into a black hole. I was down 4-1. I tend to feel pretty invincible in fixed step, but this man understood things about Tai Chi I had not yet discovered. The rounds in fixed step are 30-second stop time. The clock is stopped after each point. This is enough for 15-20 fast exchanges. Not much time to figure things out. I sank deep on an attack and actually moved him backward. My point. But a referee came over and said that the point didn't count because my opponent's initial structure was illegal. Strange logic. Then I scored another point that they waved off. I heard my team and Pop going crazy. I had been to this tournament twice before, and both times was shocked by the mendacity of the judges. This time the pattern was familiar to me. Basically, this is how it works. There is grand ceremony welcoming the foreigners, but they don't want us to win. The way they tend to steer results is by making some horrific calls early in the match to get the momentum going in the direction of the local player. Usually, when a foreign competitor starts to feel that the match is rigged, he gets increasingly desperate and over-aggressive. Instead of competing with presence, he becomes overwrought and caught up in a downward spiral. His game falls apart. Then, once the Taiwanese player is in control of the match, the judging becomes exceedingly fair. In fact, they become overly kind to create the illusion of fairness. I knew all of this coming in. The key was to keep on winning points, and to immediately come back from a bad call with a huge surge. Don't get rattled. If I controlled the momentum of the game, it would be hard for judges to take matches away. That was the plan. To be honest, I also felt a lot of love for my opponent in this match. The whole stadium was against me, except for our U.S. contingent of 10. I didn't blame the Taiwanese for wanting their man to win. I was down 3 points and needed to come back. He won another one. I had to stop the slide right now, or I wouldn't be able to catch up. I'd created a move 2 months earlier that I thought might be decisive in the tournament. We called it the bear hug. I would allow my opponent to come straight in on my chest with a hard attack. My two arms circled fast behind him, and on the push I sank deep while pulling him down with me. I could also crank left or right with it. When applied cleanly, it's disturbing to have this done to you, because it feels like you're falling into a void and at the same time your wrist is exploding. No choice but to go down. I let him in, bear hug, put him on the floor. 2 points. He was up 5-3, but hadn't ever seen the bear hug before. I used it again and spun him right. Down 5-4. Now the judge came over and tried to mess with my head. He told me to adjust my left hand position on the starting posture. Just psychological manipulation. I smiled at the ref and kept fighting. Bear hug again. It's even. Now my opponent stepped off the mats and came back with a different feeling. He was beginning to understand. He changed his left arm to trap my right if I bear hugged. He had answers and I had new variations. We were flowing now, moves coming fast like speed chess in Washington Square Park. This fixed-step game is a sublime experience. At first it feels fast and jolty, like a painful guessing game, but then the play slows down in your mind. Over the years, as I became more and more relaxed under this kind of fire, and as my body built up enough resistance that the blows didn't bother me, the game became completely mental. It almost always felt as though I was seeing or feeling the action in more frames than my opponents, and so I could zoom in on the tiniest details, like the blink of an eye, or the beginning of an exhalation. When our wrists connected, I usually felt exactly what my opponent would come at me with, and I learned how to apply the subtlest of pressures in order to dictate his intention. But this great fixed-step fighter imposed his own reality. I couldn't get in his head. Or every time I got in, he kicked me back out. I tried the bear hug again, but he jammed it. He'd figured it out. My own teammates hadn't learned how to parry the bear hug in 2 months of work. This guy took seconds. I was down 7-5, without much time left in the round. I faked a hard attack, but then slipped in a right underhook and threw him away. I was down 1 point with 1.1 seconds left. I needed to score fast and surged hard with a 4-strike combination that scored at the bell. Round 1 was a tie. Barely. The second round is always played with the left foot forward. For some reason, my opponent's structure didn't feel quite as solid with the legs reversed in the opening position. I began sinking deeply on my attacks, playing with feints, tight combinations, and misdirection. I noticed that if I faked in my mind, without even moving, he felt it and responded. He was incredibly sensitive to intention, so I started unbalancing him with invisible attacks that I pulsed into but didn't actually manifest physically. I was getting in his head. He felt it and got aggressive, attacked hard, and blasted me away. But now I had him attacking, and I knew I had a deeper root. I started receiving his blows and bouncing him off, won a bunch of points. Then I made the mistake of coming straight in, and he threw me on the floor, 2 points. If I lowered the sophistication of my game a hair, he destroyed me. He slipped into a zone and attacked hard. We were even with 3 seconds to go in the round. I uprooted him with a 4-prong combination, most of which didn't actually happen. Then I took the next point at the bell with a huge surge and won the round. Round 3. Right leg forward again. This was where he liked it, but me too. We started trading points back and forth, a war. My team was chanting, "Tiger, Tiger, Boumaye." Bruce used to call me Tiger in the Young Chess days, and it stuck. The rest of the crowd was chanting in Mandarin. They loved him, and I didn't blame them. Then I noticed a hole. He had found the solution to my bear hug, trapping my right forward elbow so I couldn't get outside of him. But if I flashed my mind to the bear hug, in jamming it, he opened up his armpit to inside pummeling techniques. I started taking the underhook and tossing him left and right. Every point I was playing with invisible feints, which he somehow felt, and then I exploited his reactions. Trippy idea. I was using his crazy perceptiveness against him. Finally, I caught a throw, where I got the right underhook and cranked him all the way over and around me. He hit the ground hard. In that moment, I felt a wave of sorrow, like I killed the last unicorn. The match ended and we hugged. I told him he was an inspiration. Fixed and moving step finals ahead, both against the Buffalo. We'd been measuring each other for the past 2 days. We both knew that this mammoth international competition would come down to our own little war. In moving step, he was a force of nature. He overwhelmed his opponents with bull rushes and highly evolved throws. His pummeling was incredible. Dan and I had broken his game down and saw that he integrated very precise trips and sweeps into most of his throws. I had to neutralize his footwork and power, not get steamrolled out of the ring, counterpunch, and look for holes. That was the plan. There was a 1-hour break before all the final matches. Fixed would be first, which was good. I'd seen a weakness in Buffalo's structure and was hoping to get in his head before the moving. I was ready for war, listening to Lose Yourself on the headphones. I felt myself stealing against the world, like a freight train that just had its brakes cut. Fixed Step, World Championship Finals. Buffalo walked toward the Fixed Step ring, stopped just short of me, looked me dead in the eyes, and screamed something primal, from the gut. One note. A chant called back from the bleachers, and then the stadium exploded. This was their man. Our wrists touched, and he was all aggression. Good. I had to use that. Keep him there. On the first point, he surged into an attack that put me airborne. Then he came right back at me, but I let him in, circled around his elbows with my hands and sank deep. Bear hug. He went right down. 2 points. At the beginning of every exchange, we stood right leg forward, the backs of our wrists connected, waiting for the ref's command to set play in motion. Those seconds of standoff are psychologically complex. You can calm an opponent or challenge his ego, make him lust for aggression. Over and over I lulled him forward with tiny little openings. He was like a bull seeing red, charging in hard and fast, and I was always gone before he connected. I won 2 points that the ref waved off. I heard people grumbling about the officiating, but at this point I didn't care. I was a bit of a madman, deep in the zone. I knew that the only way to win was to win big. The bear hug was deadly against Buffalo's power. He kept on hitting the floor and seemed confused. Round 1 was a blowout. In round 2, I felt unstoppable. I didn't care about the refs or the score. I kept winning 1 point after the next, and I heard Dan and my teammates chanting, "Tiger, Boumaye, Tiger, Boumaye." I was in his head and kept on coming. My father said this was his favorite match, that it was a beautiful emotional experience to watch. To me, it felt technical. I won it before stepping in the ring. Afterward, my team mobbed me, and Max lifted me into the air. The stadium was silent but for the voice of my pop and the guys around me. I was world champion. Now let's see if I could do it twice. Moving step finals. Buffalo entered the ring screaming, wild, fists pumping the air. I had felt his mortality and fixed, which was good, but the moving step would be his legacy. He'd trained his whole life to be world champion. I had no solutions to his game, only ideas. He was surely the greater athlete, but maybe I was the better thinker. The bell rang, and they went right on the attack, pummeling in for the underhooks. For a few seconds I fought for the inside position, but he felt too powerful, and I decided to give it to him. No reason to meet him head on. His left arm pummeled deep under my right armpit and wrapped up my shoulder. My right foot was forward, and my right arm locked down on his left upper arm. He had better leverage for edging me out and for certain throws, but I had some excellent weapons as well. When the timing felt right, I cranked to the left. We went down hard together. I instigated the throw, but my left elbow touched just before he crashed down. His point, 1-0. My shirt was ripped up. I didn't mind the caveman feeling, but the officials made me change it. I'd lost the first point, but felt potential. Play resumed. We connected. I disconnected. Then came straight in on him and tried to jump around and take his back, but he was too quick and wrapped me up. We separated. I danced around him, tried to enter fast and spin him, but nothing there. We felt each other out. Then he cranked hard. I went with it, spun with the force and stayed on my feet, but when I landed he was on me, pushing hard. I rooted it out, but he kept on coming, relentless, and he edged me out of the ring. I'm down 2-0. About a minute to go in round one. I tried a couple of things, but couldn't find a hole. He was confident, too strong. I needed to use that strength. There was nothing else. I went into the clinch and leaned on him, let him feel my weight and also my exhaustion. He started to edge me out of the ring, and I let him take me there. He was cautious, tiny steps, no overextension. My back was to the edge. I planted my left foot an inch from the line and exploded, drove hard against his right arm, screaming, putting everything I had into this throw. He couldn't hold on, and I took him out of the ring and then went down hard on top of him. It's 2-1, 11 seconds left in the round. I needed a point, and I was tapped out. Dan was screaming. My whole team was chanting, "Tiger, Tiger, Boumaier, faster and faster. I need to go buck wild now. Need one point. Gotta let it all hang out." The ref said go, and I hit him like a truck. He gave a little, then held his ground, trying to hold on for the bell. I cranked, and we started spinning, my back to the edge, then his, then mine again. Total chaos. I screamed as I pulled hard and reversed him. He was on the edge, but he had the underhooks, was okay. Incredible root. And then all I can say is that I reached deeper than I knew I had, and won the most dramatic point of my life. With 1 second left, I drove him out of the ring, launching through him and over him, landing him on his back, my shoulder into his, and my head over him and straight into the ground. The bell rang. The crowd went totally wild, even the Taiwanese. 2-2. I had 60 seconds. And was a dead man. I lay panting on my back for almost all of that time. On the video, Buffalo looks physically strong, but upset. Max rubbed my shoulders. I slowed down my breathing. Thought I'd be okay by the bell. Hoped. Wasn't so sure. Round 2. He entered the ring like an enraged beast, and the bleachers erupted in chants. I remember getting to my feet and walking slowly to the center, hoping I could reach it without falling over. He attacked immediately, and the force went through me, into the ground. It felt like an electric current, and I bounced him off, awake now, ready to roll. No more pain. He came at me again, and cranked hard into a throw while sweeping out my right foot, but I felt it coming, stepped up with my left, and neutralized it while crimping his arms. I knew I had to watch that footwork. Very dangerous. We went back into the clinch. I gave him the left underhook, and clamped down on the arm. He probed for a hole, and I held him off, waiting. Listening. The game had grown smaller now, everything slowing down. He switched his weight into his front leg to attack, and I caught it, fired into a throw in that flash that he was stuck, his foot entering the ground, no way to move, and he went down with me right on top of him, my shoulder into his left side, up 1-0. He came right back at me, shaking off the last moment with a bull rush, but I felt it coming and went with the force, pulled him a little farther, and he hit the ground, up 2-0. Then I pulled off another throw, catching the same hole in his footwork, perfect timing, in a reap. We both went up and I landed on him hard. I'm up 3-0. Now, I made my only real mistake of the tournament. I had him totally defeated. He came at me, and I popped him to the side, his left foot landing inches from the edge. Then I should have backed off or gone in slow. But I smelled the finish line and charged, overextended, and he put me down. 2 points, 3-2. He's back in it. My mistake. Not much time left. I'm spent. So is he. Here things really started to go out of control. He surged right at me. I used the force and almost put him down, but he barely saved himself. We flew all over the place, him attacking, me neutralizing, counterattacking, him saving. I heard Max scream, "Josh, 15 seconds!" I put a huge effort into a throw that he barely stopped. He charged, I warded it off, and I was exhausted. It felt like the 15 seconds were over. Now, 2 years later, I see on the video. Max is waving at the timekeeper. The woman is standing, holding the bell. What happened here was surreal. There were many witnesses, all with the same story. The clock hit 2 minutes, and the woman went to hit the bell, but an official motion for her not to ring it. Clock went to 2:04, 2:05, 2:06. We were scrambling in the ring, in total mayhem. I'd paced myself to last 15 seconds, and now I was way past blown out. I was up 3-2, and they were holding the bell. Everyone was screaming. I was dead on my feet, and the Buffalo put his heart, soul, blood, and guts into one more throw. I couldn't hold it off and started to go. He piled down on top of me, won the point, and they rang the bell. 3-3. Officially, the first two rounds were tied. I was on my back, slowing down my breathing, far beyond the most exhausted I've ever been. Max and Dan rubbed my arms and shoulders. The bell rang. Round 3. It all comes down to this. I had the tiebreak if we were even. At this point, it's pure guts. Survival. You operate on another plane of reality, second to second, relying on your training to keep you standing. The round began, and I held him off, then gave him the double underhooks and launched into a throw I've been working on for years and hadn't shown yet at the tournament. I trapped his right arm under my left elbow, pulsed forward to provoke a reaction, and then turned left, rolling over my right shoulder and his trapped right arm, all my weight pulling down and away from his root. He flew over me in a big circle, and we went down hard, my shoulder into his ribs. Perfectly executed, but the judges didn't give it to me. I was too tired to be angry about it. They said we touched the floor at the same time. His ribs wouldn't agree. No score. I didn't have much left. We felt each other out for 10 seconds. Then he attacked, forced a lean, and spun me on the mat. Lovely throw. I'm down 2-0. Trouble. Gotta dig deep. Find something. Now he changed tactics and decided to hold me off, stalling out the round. I searched for over a minute, spent. On the video, it looks like I gave up. My body went limp. Then I saw a hole and exploded into the same throw they just took away from me. But at the end, I pushed off hard, incidentally against my ankle, which was turned 90 degrees, arched my back and landed flat on him so they couldn't argue. My point, 2-1. Need one more from somewhere. It felt like one of those video games, where the endurance of the fighter is gone, and you have to hold the other guy off, survive the barrage until you've recovered enough to give him one more shot. That's what I had to do, hold him off until I had a little bit in me, and then put every ounce of it into a throw that had to be perfectly timed, because if it didn't work, I might just collapse. Then I found a little opening. I got into the clinch, trapped his right arm, faked forward, and drove my whole being into a bicep throw. He went down. I landed on him, shoulder to ribs, the tying point. There were 19 seconds left. All I have to do is hold him off, and I win. Except at this moment, everything turned very, very strange. Once again, the judges decided not to allow my throw. They claimed it was illegal. Now people rushed onto the floor, Americans and Taiwanese officials. Our team had cameras shooting the match, and soon a gaggle of officials and players from both teams were looking at the video cameras. The stadium went berserk with anger and confusion. The judges convened, the president of the Taiwanese Federation, my teacher, Master Chen, my whole team, my opponent's team, everyone on the mats looking at the videos. There were 15 minutes of mayhem, bickering, politics. Interestingly, my opponent's coach and his whole team considered the ruling against me an outrage. They told me this afterward. By all accounts, my throw was legal. It was astonishing that hometown referees would do this in the final minute of a match for the world title. After a long dispute, the judges said that this challenge would have to be resolved after the match. But for now, I was down by 1, the throw would not be counted, and there were 19 seconds left. I had to continue, or I would lose by forfeit. Well, in those 19 seconds, I gave it my all. I attacked him with everything I had, made the situation totally chaotic, and cranked into a throw that would have put him down in training, but he gave up his body, literally. His elbow bent all the way back. It was exploding inside, but he wouldn't give up and stayed on his feet until the bell rang. Such heart. Then I just sat down and watched chaos take over. Witnesses came from all over who had seen the clock run out in round two when the judge had refused to allow the woman to ring the bell. There was a meeting held in the center of the stadium with videos shown to the president of the Taiwanese Tai Chi Federation, to the judges, to everybody. My opponent's coach, Chen Zicheng's father, an honorable man, agreed with the president that this was wrong. They suggested a shared championship. I went over to the head referee and demanded a clear winner. Overtime. I knew I could take him. The opposing coach agreed to a 2-minute sudden-death playoff to decide the world championship. We would have international judges. They went to find the buffalo. For 20 minutes I paced the arena, red hot. If there was a place beyond the zone, I was there. But it turned out that Buffalo's elbow was too severely injured. The ruling was a shared title and moving step. In a flash, it was over. No more battles to fight. The martial fury subsided, and in its place came pain, mellowness, and camaraderie. Buffalo and I swayed on the first place podium together, hugging and holding each other up. Afterward. 2 years after the madness of that world championship in Taiwan, I'm still digesting the experience. Never in my life have I had to dig so deeply into myself. Not even close. It was thrilling, and also a bit alienating. I saw parts of myself I didn't know about. To survive and win, I became a gladiator, pure and simple. I hadn't fully understood that he was inside of me, waiting. But surely all the work I had done for years had made him possible. Perhaps inevitable. How did this new part of myself relate to the Josh I'd known my whole life? The kid who was once scared of the dark. The chess player. The young man who loves the rain and rereading passages of Jack Kerouac. How did it fit in with my passion for Buddhism and the Satyagraha of Mahatma Gandhi? Honestly, these are questions that I'm still sorting out. Do I want to explore more of the side of myself? Maybe. But perhaps in a different guise. Mainly what I felt after Taiwan was an urgent desire to get back to practice and shake off the idea that I'd climbed my mountain. In the last 2 years, I've started over, a new beginning. There are great adventures ahead. The writing of this book has spanned an intense and unlikely stretch of years. As a kid growing up in my tiny room, I could never have dreamed that such battles awaited me. While writing these pages, my ideas have evolved, loves have fallen apart and come anew. World championships were lost and won. If I have learned anything over my first 29 years, it's that we cannot calculate our important contests, adventures, and great loves to the end. The only thing we can really count on is getting surprised. No matter how much preparation we do, in the real tests of our lives, we'll be in unfamiliar terrain. Conditions might not be calm or reasonable. It may feel as though the whole world is stacked against us. This is when we have to perform better than we ever conceived of performing. I believe the key is to have prepared in a manner that allows for inspiration, to have laid the foundation for us to create under the wildest pressures we ever imagined. It's my hope that you, the reader, emerge from this book inspired and perhaps a bit more enabled to follow your dreams in a manner that's consistent with the unique gifts you bring to the table. That has been my ambition. The ideas I've shared in these pages have worked for me, and it's my hope that they suggest a structure and direction. But there is no such thing as a fixed recipe for victory or happiness. If my approach feels right, take it, hone it, give it your own flavor. Leave my numbers behind. In the end, mastery involves discovering the most resonant information and integrating it so deeply and fully, it disappears and allows us to fly free.
Hello, you sexy people out there. This is Tim Ferriss, and this episode of the Tim Ferriss Podcast has a very special guest, Josh Waitzkin, whom I met in 2007 after reading his spectacular book, The Art of Learning. Josh, you may know from Searching for Bobby Fischer. He was the subject of both the book and the movie. He's thought of as a chess prodigy, although that term prodigy, I don't believe applies to him well at all, because he has a method for learning, mastering, refining any skill, whether that is chess, whether that is Tai Chi, in which he's multiple-time world champion, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, in which he's a black belt under the phenom, the Michael Jordan of the sport, Marcelo Garcia. And he's worked with people ranging from Mark Messier, six-time Stanley Cup winner, to Cal Ripken Jr., to the top hedge fund managers in the world. He is a performance specialist and also a very dear friend of mine now at this point. And I ended up loving his book, The Art of Learning, so much that I acquired the rights to his audiobook. If you want to find that, it's read by Josh himself. And you can just go to 4hourblog, fourhourblog.com, and search for Tim Ferriss Book Club, or go to Google and do the same. So without further ado, let's get straight to the meat of the interview. I hope you enjoy it. So Josh, I figure we might as well start at the top and do a little retrospective. What led you initially to write The Art of Learning? And of course, that's how I was in many ways introduced to your work, and then through our mutual friend Max ended up connecting. But what was the reason you decided to write that book?
Yeah, you know, I initially started thinking about the idea of the book about 2 years into my martial arts life. So I transitioned from chess into studying East Asian philosophy. Then I started getting into Tai Chi Chuan and ultimately into the martial application of it, Pushan. And I started to experience this very interesting transition from the principles. My level in chess just began to translate directly over into the martial arts. And I think it was primarily one experience I had. It was something around 2 years into my Tai Chi training. I was giving a simultaneous chess exhibition in Memphis, Tennessee, at a fundraiser for muscular dystrophy. And I was playing 45 or 50 boards at once. So I'm walking down the middle of this big square of chess tables. Everyone's playing one game. I'm playing each of them. And about 40 minutes into the simul, I had this experience that was so interesting. I began to feel like I was riding the energetic wave of the game like I was in my push-hands training. I wasn't playing chess. I wasn't thinking in chess language. I wasn't calculating variations. I was feeling the flow, filling the space behind like I would in the martial arts. And I had this realization, you know, I was playing beautiful chess, but I wasn't consciously playing chess, that the barriers between these two different arts had dissolved in my mind. And that's when I started to conceive of the idea of the book. And a lot of the process of, I spent 5 years taking notes, maybe 400 or 500 pages of notes in the book before I actually sat down and wrote it. And a lot of that process was deconstructing what I'd been doing rather intuitively. So essentially what it felt like was translation of parallel learning. These are two rather abstract terms. That's the language that I was using internally when I was first thinking about the book, because it felt like I was just taking the essence of one art and translating it over into another. And then the process of writing it involved deconstructing what I'd been doing somewhat abstractly into something that could be replicated more systematically.
So the question that jumps out in my mind, which is a bit of a side note perhaps, but is simuls, playing 10, 20, 30, 40 boards simultaneously. I'll try to ask a better question than how does someone do that, but at what point, what happens to a chess player when they go from an inability to play multiple boards simultaneously to being able to play multiple boards simultaneously? What is the sort of framework or thinking or experience that someone built up that allows them to do something like that, which to the average person seems like a Rain Man-like feat?
You know, I think it's different for every chess player. I mean, one of the beautiful things about chess is that you can approach it so many different ways. And to be world-class, what you need to do essentially is express the core of your being through the art. I think this is true of many arts, and that's probably something we'll get into more deeply. So you can have a very mathematical person who plays chess mathematically. You can have a very musical person who plays chess musically. Someone might be much more kinesthetic like myself, and sort of a feeling for flow and hidden harmonies and almost a physically energetic relationship to chess. Mm-hmm. When I first learned to play chess, when I was 6 years old in Washington Square Park, it was a battle. I loved the feeling of just going into a fight with someone and finding these hidden harmonies and finding where these animal passions mixed with this technical complexity. And when I get much later, when I got much better playing simuls, it was sort of a higher level manifestation of that same kind of dynamic. I mean, for me, playing simuls was it's something akin to juggling a lot of balls, and all of the to each chess, I wasn't playing 40 different games, for example, separately. The flow of all 40 games would sort of coalesce into one larger sense of flow. And it was actually really interesting. Whenever, so often when I'd give a simul and there'd be a youth competition, and the winners of the youth competition would play against me. And so sometimes kids would cheat. They'd really want to beat me, so they would cheat. So I'd be walking around this big thing, and then I'd get to the table, and they'd have moved, shifted the position to try to win, because if they could win, it would be a big thing. And my experience when that happened was as if you had, imagine you had like 40 balls up in the air, and suddenly they would all crash onto the floor.
Yeah.
And I would know that they had changed the position, not by reaching the board and remembering what the position was and then seeing they changed it. It would initially be this feeling of the energetic flow had been interrupted. And then I'd have to reverse engineer myself back to that one game, that one component of the flow, and then I'd remember the game, and then I would remember exactly what the position had been, and then I'd say, ha-ha, this is the position. And then it would take me two or three times going back around to get that all the balls back up in the air to get back to the energetic flow. So actually, for me, giving simuls sort of felt similar to playing chess, one chess game. But that was my own relationship to it. I think that probably if you asked 10 different very strong chess players, that all give somewhat different answers.
Got it. Yeah, this, you know, one thing that blew me away was spending time with a friend of yours, Maurice, when we went to Washington Square Park, and seeing him play a game, at least for the first portion, without looking at the board. And I'm not gonna, I won't give away too much of the punchline, since we captured it all in a film. It was pretty amazing. But just his ability to track the board, it seemed like by chunking portions of the board into sort of larger, like gestalt pieces. I don't know if that's the best way to express it, but it seemed like his ability to seemingly remember all these disparate pieces was because he had it broken, the board broken down into sort of component chunks, as it were. But I don't want to take us too down that fine line. Let's shift gears. What I'd be very curious to know is, you know, at this point, what because I know, of course, a little bit of the background, but I want to dig into the details. What type of people do you personally work with these days, and why do they work with you? What type of things do you do with them?
Yeah. Well, I have three major dimensions to my creative life right now. Well, maybe four. I guess the most important one is my son Jack, who he's a little over 2 years old and love of my life. So that's maybe the most important part of my life, no question about it. I run a nonprofit educational foundation, and we have called the JW Foundation, the Art of Learning Project, and we have a couple hundred programs in schools around the country, internationally as well. And so this is integrating these principles that have been developing in schools, working with teachers, parents, and children around this individualized and thematic relationship to learning that I've been developing. So this is one dimension. The other one is I own a martial arts school, a Brazilian jiu-jitsu school, with Marcelo Garcia, who's the 9-time world champion. You know him well, Tim. Mm-hmm. He's just made really the Michael Jordan of the grappling world. So this is world-class athletes training there. And then I run a consulting business where I'm training people who are at the cutting edge of the finance world. And this is really interesting work, because we're focusing on that last 1% or 0.1% of the learning process, which is really my specialty. It's highly individualized. It's cutting-edge work on their learning process, their idea generation, their creativity, their performance psychology, their resilience. Fascinating work. And, you know, what I've discovered, it's interesting, because I wrote this book called The Art of Learning years ago, and so people are always coming to me to speak about learning, but much of what I've been focused on in recent years has been unlearning.
Hmm.
When I think about that last movement, you know, from the equivalent of being, say, number 10 to number 1 in the world, to number 5 to being number 1 in the world, it's much more about finding subtle obstructions, finding friction points, releasing them, identifying cognitive biases that might be blocking your way. It's the movement towards unobstructed self-expression. So if you think about your creative process as a hose with a big crimp in it, if you release it, just unbelievable pressure can be released. And a lot of what I'm doing with people is trying to move them from very good to great, or from great to truly elite, by deeply individualized work on helping them really find ways to express the core of their being through their art, which is, as you know, a big theme in my life. From when I played chess at my highest level, that's what I was doing. When I had a period of being really locked up in my chess career, which which we can go into in more detail if you want, I was doing the opposite. I was trying to fit into someone else's mold. And then ultimately, when I transitioned away from chess into the martial arts, I returned to that experience of self-expression. And that's when I really started to understand it very deeply. I think it was the crisis towards the end of my chess career which really laid the foundation for the work that I do today with brilliant mental performers who are just trying to make that movement to the equivalent to world champion.
To jump actually back to Marcelo for a second, because I've of course met Marcelo, and he's just...
And you've gone to war with him, and I've watched you.
I've gone to war with him, which I, if there's anything at stake, I don't recommend. And
he's a tough guy. He's caused me a lot of pain over the years.
He's a tough guy, but also a sweetheart of a guy. And he's so fluid. What I'd love to hear from you, of course, because in the art of learning, which some people might be familiar with, they read about your experiences in chess, your experiences in Tai Chi, the parallels between them, and this sort of overarching, you know, framework for optimizing mental and physical performance, if that's a fair way to put it, which is, you know, the art of learning, these different techniques and strategies. What have you learned through this third art of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu? What are some insights or strategies that you've had since moving from Tai Chi, which is in some ways similar but also very different from Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which a lot of people would be familiar with through the UFC and mixed martial arts?
Right. Yeah, I mean, to put it in context relative to my life, so the art of learning ends with the 2004 World Championship. It ends with describing the narrative of that. It was just absolutely harrowing, crazy experience. I won't give the punchline, but it was really intense. And after this, I decided I wanted to be a beginner again, to put on a white belt, literally and figuratively. And so I took on this third major mountain in my life, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I was training out on the West Coast for about a year when I was actually writing The Art of Learning. I was training Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu twice a day. This was after I'd spent 5 years taking notes. Then I had the 2004 Worlds. Then I was writing it. I started training with John Machado out there. Then I came back to New York. I started training with Marco Santos here, and I started developed this relationship with Marcelo, who's just the greatest grappler to ever live. And we were doing a lot of private lessons. We developed a friendship. Then he moved to Florida, and I would travel to Florida to work with him. And ultimately, I made the decision I wanted to bring him to New York, mostly because I was at that point planning to make a run for the world championship in this art. And there was no better way to do it than to get my ass kicked by the very best to ever live in the sport. He's just a wonderful guy, and he's just unbelievable martial artist. And so we opened up the school together, and I've been on the mats with him, you know, other than when one of us has been injured, and it's been a lot of injuries in these sports just all the time. And it's been a fascinating experience. I mean, Marcelo is so profoundly different from me. I'm a really conceptual guy. I think abstractly. Of course, my foundation in chess. Marcelo is one of the most, well, he's the most kinesthetically overdeveloped person I've ever met. And of course, overdevelopment and underdevelopment tend to come hand in hand conceptually.
Can you give me an example of that? What would be an example?
Of overdevelopment and underdevelopment?
Of kinesthetic, what it means to be kinesthetically well-developed.
Physical intelligence is mind-boggling. I mean, when you come fishing with me, you throw him on a stand-up paddleboard in 3-foot chop, and everyone just flies off of paddleboards when they just stand up on them, and he's just beautiful. I mean, he just finds the balance points. I mean, I've never seen someone learn so quickly how to handle waves, boats, handling fishing lines, being, you know, freediving, being on riding waves on paddleboards. You know, when you're in the marsh, I've been a stand-up fighter for many years. I mean, throwing is my core art. When I'm doing stand-up training with Marcelo, I caught him with most of the throws in my repertoire one time. I don't think I've ever caught him with a throw twice.
Wow.
Which is amazing. I mean, and I have guys who are world-class who I was training with. You know, I catch them thousands of times. This is a guy, he just, you almost never see Marcelo get caught more than once with something. And it's amazing to see how he relates to the world through his kinesthetic intelligence. So, for example, if you're looking, when we were looking for spaces for our school, we'd walk into a big room and I'd be thinking about the dimensions, you know, square footage, where this would be, where that would be. Marcelo would know if it felt good or felt bad.
Yep.
If he meets you, he's going to know whether he feels good about you or he feels bad about you. And
yep.
His intuition is incredibly dead on, but he navigates the world through this kinesthetic intelligence.
Yep.
And it's been a really fascinating having the school with him and diving deep with him, because we've been having conceptual dialogue for these 3.5 years or so, and he's really deepened conceptually.
Mm-hmm.
But I've learned even more deeply the importance of the lesson that there are many paths to greatness. And to take a guy like Marcelo and to try to fit him into a chess player's, you know, hyper-conceptual mold would be terrible.
Yes.
Because you'd be killing his shine. And he is so great because of his just unbelievable commitment to doing it his way.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done things in extraordinary ways. I mean, for example, you know how in these competitive arts everyone's very secret about their repertoires.
Yeah.
We have this program, which you know well, called MG in Action, where people, jiu-jitsu guys from around the world, log in to watch all of Marcelo's training sessions, his sparring sessions, his lessons, everything. When he was competing in Abu Dhabi, Submission Grappling World Championship, and Mundials, which is the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu World Championship,
mm-hmm.
we were streaming his sparring sessions every night. So he was basically showing his competitors what he was about to use against them 2 weeks, and 3 weeks, and 4 weeks. And his attitude about this, which is completely unique, is if you're studying my game, you're entering my game, and I'll be better at it than you. So simple, so pure. And if you think about it, it's really deep.
Yeah.
The opposite of what most chess players would do, and most jiu-jitsu guys would do. And so he's wide open to constant learning. And the other beautiful thing about Marcelo is, you know, people call him the king of scrambles. And if you watch his training style, he's always in transition, which is a really interesting idea to think about in a cross-disciplinary manner. Because most people get their egos involved in their training and they're trying to dominate all the time. And to dominate in almost anything, you find a position of dominance and you keep it. But Marcelo always lets his opponents move. And so he's constantly playing in transition. And so if you think about what world-class martial arts means, and you brought up, for example, Maurice Ashley and playing chess in Washington Square, it's similar. If you're at a much higher level than someone, you can always seem mystical because you're doing things which are outside of their conceptual scheme. The way that operates in the martial arts is, if you think about it through the lens of frames, right? If you and I are looking at a position, and in your mind, there's this position leads to this position leads to this position. So there's three positions. In my mind, if I'm constantly training at the transitions between these positions, these actually expand into these transitional frames, become positions to me. And so if I'm seeing 100 positions when you're seeing, say, two, then I can play in your blind spots and it can seem mystical to you because you haven't trained there. And that's what Marcelo does. By spending all of his time in transition, he's cultivated the art to play in the in-between, which is really what level is all about, or one of the core things that highlight that world-class martial arts is all about, playing in transition, in gaps that, you know, in your opponent's sight pattern.
Observing and practicing with Marcelo, say, on the guillotine or the Marcelotine, just blew me away, because if you look at it as an uninformed spectator or even just a moderately informed spectator, you're blown away by how fast he is, how effective he is, but the nuance of sort of eliciting movement, allowing space to open, manufacturing space by, say, applying pressure and then relieving it, is so subtle and so incredibly effective. I mean, then you start to notice it from these principles that carry over to many, many hundreds of possible positions, let's just say. It's really amazing. I mean, it reminds me of something I heard once from a musician, which was, I don't know who the original quote is from, but he said that, you know, music is the space between the notes. And I was like, huh, that's a really interesting way to look at it. But what were you going to say?
I was going to say, I mean, I think that's just a gorgeous quote. And I think that that's most great arts are defined by that space in between.
Yeah. Well, it's like writing is the same way, right? It's like, you know, when in doubt, leave it out. It's just like, you know, it's, I think,
Beautiful, beautiful point. And, you know, of course, the thing about Marcelo is that it can often seem initially that he's moving so fast, but what's incredible is that he can also move very slow and do things that you don't see.
Mm-hmm.
Just like a great sleight of hand artist who's just practicing the art of illusion when we're not practicing it. it's amazing what can be done with intention, with controlling someone's intention. And this is a lot of my training in push hands related to finding ways to essentially control someone's intention so that you were ahead of them, even if if they were ultimately moving first, you were there before they arrived. Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating psychological component of really high-level training in anything.
Well, I remember an interview, or it wasn't an interview. It was an interview, actually, with one of the top K-1 fighters back in the day.
Yeah.
And they were talking about Peter Aerts. I don't know if you remember the Dutch lumberjack. Huge guy. And he seemed fast. And I remember what people said. A number of opponents said, you know, he's actually not that fast. He's kind of a big lumbering guy, but he's so good at predicting timing that he sees you telegraph before you even have the thought to throw the punch, and he beats you to the punch as a result of that. But it's because he picks up on the cues faster than other people. And I thought that was very interesting. To try to bridge this to something else, I mean, what you work with, of course, I'm not going to mention names, but you work with some of the most stunningly successful and famous traders and people in finance. I mean, some real kind of masters of the universe type folks. What have you found unique about that group of people? Let's just start with that. I'm curious to know kind of what you've noticed, being as observant as you are, about that group of folks.
Oh, that's a big question.
It is a big question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, I think a core principle to start with is that there are many paths to greatness. I mean, each one of these guys who's really world-class is doing it his way. And he's harnessing his eccentricities. He's cultivating his or her strengths as a way of life. There's not an excessive focus on weakness. There's just an embracing of deep, deep study of the preconditions to someone's finest moments of expression and building lifestyles around it. And that's a lot of what I do, is help people understand what makes them tick on a very, very deep level, mm-hmm. relative to, their cognitive biases, where they're locked up, and where their greatest intent has come. What kind of external conditions, what kind of internal conditions. And the ones who are really at the top are people who have mastered this art of deep introspection and taking the result of these introspective processes and turning them into training systems and into a way of life. And it's fascinating how the process works. I mean, what I do with these guys is if after I do my initial diagnostic process, I have ways of revamping their daily architecture, the way they live their life, so that they're, for example, aligning their peak energy periods with their peak creativity work.
Mm-hmm.
They're building lifestyles that are just relentlessly proactive, as opposed to reacting to inputs. They're building a daily architecture which is based on maximizing the creative process. And if you think about this relative to most people, a simple case in point is email checking, right? Most people, when they finish a break, even top guys in industries, when they finish a break, whether they wake up first thing in the morning, what do most people do? They check their email.
Mm-hmm.
When they come back from a workout, whether they check their email. When they come back from lunch, what do? They check their email. And so what you see is this, whenever they're coming back from something after a break, they're soaking in inputs. And so they live this reactive lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Their creative process is dominated by external noise as opposed to internal music.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what I work on with guys is creating rhythms in their life that really are based on feeding the unconscious mind, which is the wellspring of creativity,
mm-hmm.
information, and then tapping it. So, for example, ending the workday with high-quality focus on a certain area of complexity where you could use an insight, and then waking up first thing in the morning, pre-input, and applying your mind to it, journaling on it.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much to do a big brainstorm, but to tap what you've been working on unconsciously overnight, which, of course, is a principle that Hemingway wrote about when he spoke about the two core principles in his creative writing process were, one, ending the workday with something left to write.
Yep. Often mid-sentence, even.
Right.
Yep.
So not doing everything he had to do, which most people do because they feel the sense of guilt if they're not working. You and I have discussed this at length. Mm-hmm. But leaving something left to write and then waking up. And then second principle, release your mind from it. Don't think about it all night. Really let go. Have a glass of wine.
Mm-hmm.
Then wake up first thing in the morning and reapply your mind to it. And it's amazing because you're basically feeding the mind complexity and then tapping that complexity or tapping what you've done with it. And, I mean, this rhythm, you know, the large variation of it is overnight. Then you can do microbursts of it throughout the day before workouts, pose a question, do a workout, release your mind after workout, return to it, and do a creative burst before you go to the bathroom, before you go to lunch, before anything. And there's ways of systematically training yourself to generate the crystallization experience, the aha moment, that can happen once a month or once a year. A lot of what I do is work on systems to help it happen once a day or four times a day. And when you're talking about guys who run financial groups of $20 to $30 billion, for example, if they have a huge insight, that can have unbelievable value. Mm-hmm. And so if you can really train people to get systematic about nurturing their creative process, it's unbelievable what can happen. And most of that work relates to getting out of your own way at a very high level. It's unlearning. It's the constant practice of subtraction, reducing friction.
What would be an example? You've mentioned cognitive biases a few times. For those people who may not be familiar with that term, what would be an example of cognitive biases and how someone might work on them?
Right. Well, there are a lot of cognitive biases that are specific to certain disciplines, like chess or mm-hmm. finance or philosophy. But if we just think about it in terms of everyday life, let's say we make a decision, and we then feel the need to justify that decision. Mm-hmm. And so we make more decisions to justify that initial decision. And then we basically get ourselves into this deep wormhole, which is caused by the attempt to justify.
The sunk cost fallacy.
Exactly.
Yep.
This is in the financial group or in the world of cognitive biases, it'll be sunk cost fallacy, right? Mm-hmm. But this is very interesting for example, a chess player who makes a certain decision. And there's a certain emotional and intellectual and time component to the value we put into the thought process behind that decision. And what we often have to do is release it because the position changes shape. A very interesting way that this manifests in chess, which you can think about rather universally, is let's say that there's a certain evaluation to the position, right? Mm-hmm. You and I are playing, Tim, and I have a slight advantage in the position, and I'm nurturing that advantage. I'm nurturing it. In a lot of complexity, I make a slight error, and suddenly the position is equalized, mm-hmm. right? So if I'm holding on to the past evaluation emotionally, where I had mm-hmm. the advantage, then what I'm going to do very subtly is I'm going to reject positions that don't give me that advantage. Mm-hmm. But if objectively I no longer have an advantage, then I'm going to be reaching too far, mm-hmm. right? And then I'm going to be rejecting things I should accept, which will make my position slip more and more and more, and you fall into what I call a downward spiral.
Yep.
So this relates to a lack of presence, which really connects to a cognitive bias, an addiction mm-hmm. to a past evaluation as opposed to a present one.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very simple example of a cognitive bias, a mental addiction, a thought construct, something that we hold to be true because of some complicated twist in our mind that it's no longer actually true. And so, of course, a very simple antidote to most of this is presence. Mm-hmm. If we can look at a moment or chess position or an investment decision or any decision with very clean presence outside of kind of emotional inertia, mm-hmm. Then we can often slice through just amazing amounts of fat with just very, very simple decisions. So if you think about the learning process, for example, this is one of the things I love about your approach to learning. The language that you and I use is, you know, I call you a master of deconstruction. You look at the way people approach different sports and you find the biases, the false constructs.
Right.
And you find the way to learn, to take a very straight path to learning, as opposed to people getting mired in all sorts of tangled webs of complexity, which are, you know, essentially caused by cognitive biases. Wouldn't mm-hmm. Isn't that how you put it?
Yeah. No, I think that's true, and I obviously appreciate the kind words. I mean, I think you and I have very complementary approaches, and like you've I think said before, and you know, I tend to focus on the sort of 80-20 analysis as it applies to people getting up and off the ground as quickly as possible to, say, you know, top whatever 5 to 10% in the general population. Whereas what's so cool about our conversations, what I enjoy so much in part, is that, you know, you're really focusing on that final leap. How do you go from being great to being the best, right? And they're very complementary skill sets. I think that what I'm looking at, and this is a way to unearth cognitive biases. And just as a side note for people who want to look into this, you can just go to Wikipedia and search list of cognitive biases, and there's a long list, which is pretty fun to read. There are a number of books about these types of things too. Think Twice, I think, is another one. the question that I ask myself, and I'm always interested in the questions that people ask themselves, because I find it in my mind that that internal dialogue is what defines your day-to-day thinking and what you think you become. So it's so critical that you ask yourself the right questions. And in my mind, when I'm trying to deconstruct, say, a sport, all I'll ask is to start with, you know, what rules are people following that are not required, right? So, you know, outside of the law and science, and even within science and within law, reality is kind of negotiable. So, I mean, a good instance of that is the high jump and the Fosbury flops. Dick Fosbury, I mean, was really the first guy to go backwards over the high jump. And up to that point, there had been straddle kicks and all sorts of different approaches. And he was, you know, ridiculed at first, and then he was called a cheat because he won the gold medal, and now everybody uses that approach. And so, you know, having a list of questions, right? Who's good at this? Who shouldn't be? Is another one that I love to ask, because you might find someone, for instance, you were talking about the different styles in chess or jiu-jitsu or in chess, you know, as sort of a reference to your first book. You know, you have attacking chess players, right? Then you have very different stylistic differences, and you have very quantitative players. And you know, for the TV show, for the Tim Ferriss Experiment, I did an episode on poker, and I've avoided poker my whole life because I viewed it as a game of chance. And I had a former computer science guy who said, no, I'm not going to teach you to be lucky because I can't teach you to be lucky, but I can teach you to run some probabilities and only bet when you have a good likelihood of a positive outcome, right? And what was so fascinating is you look at a guy like that, and you'll find highly quantitative, say, hedge fund managers, for instance, or investors of different types, tech investors, who go to the World Series of Poker, and they run the numbers. That's how they play. And then there are other guys who are completely, seemingly, flying by the seat of their pants. I mean, they're very kinesthetic. They're playing an intimidation game. They're very physical. So asking myself, for instance, you know, who's good at this, who shouldn't be, if the assumption is you have to be very good at math to be good at poker, right? Who admits to using no math, which might be misinformation, and let me look into how they do it. And then the second question is, you know, have they replicated their results? Are there other people they've taught to do what they do, to try to separate out the nature from the nurture where possible? But I want to come back to you know, the finance guys just for a second, and to ask you about rituals and routines. Then I'm going to ask you about your own. But what are some habits? And it doesn't have to be across the board with all these guys, because they have such different personalities and approaches. But with some of these you know, really super high level finance guys who are managing tens of billions of dollars. What are some of the habits that you've observed that you find interesting, or rituals, if any? Okay.
Well, let me answer that by describing some of the keystone habits that I recommend for people to internalize in the field.
Is that a good approach to this? Yeah, sure.
First of all, meditation. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're speaking about this theme of cognitive biases, or basically observing your mental addictions the moment that they set in. Meditation is as deep and as powerful a tool as I could possibly describe. I mean, it's maybe 6 or 7 years ago, when I was first talking about meditation with guys in the finance world, it seemed like some woo-woo strange thing for them to take on. Mm-hmm. But as more and more people are integrating it into their process, I mean, you wouldn't believe how many of the most powerful players in the world are meditating very deeply. Mm-hmm. It's just an amazing way of deepening the creative process, deepening presence, expanding your energetic relationship to the world, gaining insight, and realizing that most of the thinking that we do or basically springs from mental addiction. Mm-hmm. And much of people's lives are spent in an emotional swirl, which is a reactive one. And having a relationship's presence, which allows you to see through the illusion of that emotional swirl, or of those mental addictions. I mean, meditation is an incredibly powerful tool, which I know you know mm-hmm. quite deeply. I've been meditating since I was 17, 18 years old. I know it's a big part of your life as well, Tim. So that's a very, very important habit. Mm-hmm. The idea of waking up first thing in the morning and turning your mind to creative work pre-input, as opposed to checking email and getting reactive, opening up your channel to the unconscious mind first thing when you wake up in the morning, doing the same, ending the workday with quality, hugely important. I remember when I went skiing with Billy Kidd, who, as you might recall, is one of the great downhill racers from back in, I think, the 60s Olympic ski team. Awesome dude. Now he's out in Colorado wearing a cowboy hat. just a timeless guy, brilliant dude. And, you know, he was saying to me years ago when I first skied with him, Josh, what do you think are the three most important turns of the ski run? And, you know, I've asked that question to a lot of people since. And most people will say the middle because it's the hardest, the beginning because they're getting momentum. Billy describes the three most important turns of the ski run are the last three before you got in the lift. It's a very, very subtle point. And it, for those of you who are skiers, you know that, you know, that's when the slope is leveled off, there's less challenge. Most people are very sloppy then. They're taking the muscles off of, they're taking the weight off the muscles they've been using. They have bad form. The problem with that is that on the lift ride up, unconsciously, you're internalizing bad body mechanics. As Billy points out, if your last three turns are precise, then what you're internalizing the lift right up is precision. So I carry this on to, you know, the guys who I train in the finance world, for example, ending the workday with very high quality, which opens up, you know, for one thing, you're internalizing quality overnight. And we're nurturing themes as well as skills, right? It's one thing to learn skills, but the higher art is to learn themes or meta-themes that will ultimately spontaneously up into the internalization of hundreds of what I would call local habits. And so if you're practicing quality, you're deepening the muscle of quality. And you're also focusing the unconscious mind in an area of complexity, which you'll then tap first thing in the morning. So this is a core habit. Journaling, certain post-mortem processes, reflecting on the, you know, doing, ending your day with a reflection on of the quality of the work. What are the core areas of complexity that you're wrestling with? Hugely important.
You know, would you do that immediately after the end of the workday per se, before bed? How would you time that if someone wanted to try this themselves?
I time at the end of the workday before. The problem with doing these things right before bed is that then you're sort of consciously going to bed thinking about these things.
Right.
At that point, I find you want to release. So, a very core idea is, you know, when you go home, as best you can, unless you're red hot inspired, release your mind from the work. It's very important to give your stress and recovery core habit, right? You want to be turning it on and turning it off. And teaching people to turning it off is a huge part of teaching them to turn it on much more intensely. And so stress and recovery workouts, interval training, and meditation together are beautiful habits to develop to cultivate the art of turning it on and turning it off. So if you're undulating your heart rate, for example, between 170, 172, 174, and say 144, the practice of lowering your heart rate over the course of, say, 45 seconds is akin to falling asleep, releasing your tension. And then as you're pushing your heart rate back up, you're learning to turn it on. So you're using a physical metaphor to train at the art of turning on incredible intellectual energy and then turning it off. Marcelo Garcia, who we were talking about, one of my most beautiful memories is of him in, you know, World Championship, right before going into the semifinals, raucous bleacher, everyone's screaming, yelling, he's sleeping. Sleep on the bleacher. You wake him up. He sort of stumble into the ring. You've never seen a guy more relaxed before going into a world championship fight. And then he can turn it off so deeply. And man, when he goes in the ring, you can't turn it on with any more intensity than he can. And his ability to turn it off is directly aligned with how intensely he can turn it on. So training people to do this, have stress and recovery, undulation throughout their day. And then, you know, thematically, this ties into, again, this internal proactive orientation. And, you know, building a daily architecture, which is around understanding your creative process as opposed to reacting to things, feeling guilty that you're not working, really teaching people to tap into their internal compass. So those are some of the core themes and habits that I would bring up first.
Yeah,
so I can go on. I could spend 3 hours talking about this subject.
Let's do it. We'll have a part two. The meditation I wanted to touch on for a second. I mean, as you know, I've been taking that very seriously for particularly the last 6 months or so. And I received an email the other day from the teacher that I used for transcendental meditation. And there are many different types of meditation. I'm curious. I'm going to ask you about how you format your own meditating in a second. But there are many different types. I have my issues, my likes and dislikes as it relates to almost all of them, but received an email with a link to an article, and the title is Bridgewater Founder Ray Dalio Credits Transcendental Meditation for His Success. And his, for those who don't know, he's the founder of the world's largest hedge fund, Bridgewater Associates. They have, what, $100 billion plus under management, I think. And his quote is, "Meditation more than any other factor has been the secret to whatever success I've had." That is a hell of an endorsement. For me, it's been getting over that resistance to what I perceived as sort of a woo-woo, new agey type thing, and the ability to sort of view it almost as just a warm bath for the mind, where I'm taking a mini vacation from my own brain in a way, which may or may not, depending on who you ask, be the most helpful way to look at it. But I found that a very kind of useful lens through which to view it. But how do you, if there is a particular type of meditation you follow, what is it? Or how do you personally meditate? I mean, what do you think of or not think of? How long do you do it, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, when I was 17, 18, I started studying very simple contemplative and quiescent Buddhist sitting meditation, where I would focus on my breath. And, you know, this is when I was a late teenager. And then I started getting involved with Tai Chi. Mm-hmm. And I started studying East Asian philosophy very deeply. And this is where I got increasingly into moving meditation, mm-hmm. which is the most deep practice, or the practice that I've personally done most deeply, mm-hmm. Tai Chi form meditation. So the meditative form of Tai Chi is sort of the essence of the art, and then the fighting application is what I was competing in. Mm-hmm. And so I spent many years meditating 4, 5, 6 hours a day with Tai Chi. Today I combine my Tai Chi practice with sitting meditation again. Mm-hmm. Most people when they enter meditation, what I suggest is they just practice very simple sitting meditation, following their breath. And it's a practice which doesn't have to be very complex. They can, for example, just sit either cross-legged or comfortably in a chair and follow their breath. And it's very interesting because they'll notice after 1 or 2 seconds that their mind starts racing off. And usually what happens when you have really driven guys who are trying to meditate for the first time and their mind races off, they get all pissed off. They're just like, angry, frustration.
Yeah.
They feel like they're failing at meditation. And one of the most important things to do is to embrace the fact that meditation isn't about perfection. It's about the return to breath. So when you find your mind racing, you observe that and you return to your breath. And that's a tough emotional hurdle for a lot of guys. And it's very interesting because over time, you know the metaphor of basically the mind is a wild stallion that over time you're taming and you ultimately learn to still it. It's racing, it's bucking, it's pulling against anything you put it, any kind of line you put on it. But ultimately, the circles get smaller and smaller, and you learn to observe when your mind is getting caught up in some kind of mental or emotional addiction more and more quickly and fluidly. And the return to breath becomes easier and easier. And it's very interesting, by the way, as a competitor, because I relate to the theme of channeling emotion or fear, whatever is rising, as a world-class competitor, in very much the same way we might speak about meditation.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke at a conference on grit recently, and it was very interesting for me because, for the most part,
grit.
When I listen,
GRIT,
resilience,
okay. Got it.
GRIT, yeah, which is of course a core educational principle in a lot of charter schools these days, hugely important, teaching kids to be resilient.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting because when I hear people speak about resilience, and this is sort of we're moving a little bit aside from meditation, but we'll bring it back. The focus is on, for example, overcoming difficulty, suffering, learning to basically push through. What mm-hmm. people don't realize is that world-class performers, what they've done is they've reoriented their relationship to suffering, or that to the point of resistance. They've learned to embrace it. They've learned to see the beauty in these moments where there's pain, because that's incredible room for growth. And I think that a lot of what you learn to do in meditation is observe the addictive way you might be defining something. And if you want to, you can simply alter that definition. So you can change your relationship to pain or the rain or a huge storm or fear or anger. Mm-hmm. So, for example, people from the outside will use the term fearlessness, right? Mm-hmm. But if you speak to any great soldier or SEAL team member or fighter or UFC guy, they'll tell you, mixed martial arts, right, great, you know, world-class fighter, they'll tell you that they feel fear. They just know how to sit with their fear and how to work with it and how to channel it. So the idea of fearlessness is sort of a false idea which is imposed from the outside by a spectator. And when you observe world-class performers, what they've learned how to do is harness fear, nerves, anxiety, bring them in, embrace them, have a working relationship with them, and channel them into intensity. And meditation is an incredible forum or vehicle in which you can do this, because you learn to observe where you have addictive relationships, and mm-hmm. you realize that they're not absolute, and you can actually transform your relationship to any of these thought patterns, thought constructs, cognitive biases, or emotional patterns.
Yeah, I was I was looking up a quote as you mentioned that, because I wanted to get it right, but it's one of my favorite quotes from Customato, who trained boxers like Floyd Patterson, you know, Jose Torres, most famously perhaps Mike Tyson, and he would say, you know, the hero and the coward both feel the same thing, but the hero uses his fear, projects it onto his opponent while the coward runs. It's the same thing, fear, but it's what you do with it that matters. And I started meditating and gave up meditating many, many times because I had the response that you mentioned about type A personalities, where I'd be sitting there and I thought the objective was to quiet my mind, and I'll come back to that in a second. And so when I failed at quieting my mind, because it would be ticking off the to-do list or harp on these ridiculous things, and I'd get then pissed, and then I'd get pissed that I was getting pissed, and then I would get up and have a cup of coffee and like storm out of the house, which didn't seem like a productive meditation session. I actually started doing it consistently when I kept it really short, and a friend of mine recommended this, where I would, number one, be comfortable. So I would sit down, but to avoid back pain, I would actually lean against a wall, which is very commonly thought of as a big no-no. So I would lean against a wall to keep my back straight, and I would listen to one music track. I would listen to one song every morning, the same song as a cue, and I would just pay attention to my breath and focus on being an observer of my thoughts, but not trying to control them at all. So if all I did was think about my to-do list the entire time, that's fine, as long as I'm paying attention to my breath. And that non-attachment to an outcome, i.e. controlling my thoughts, was very helpful. And the format that I followed subsequent to that, and you know, we can have a longer conversation about, you know, why it finally clicked, but the short answer is accountability. I had a teacher who was going to give me a hard time if I didn't do my meditating and then report back, was 20 minutes, let's just say 10 to 20 minutes twice a day. And what I found was, by allowing the thoughts to occur and not judging myself because, let's say, I'm thinking about email or the grocery shopping I need to do or whatever, just letting that happen but getting good at observing it, I was able to then have more emotional awareness later, which would prevent cognitive biases and bad judgments. So what I mean by that is, as a concrete example, I'm an impatient guy. I always have been, ever since I was literally little kid, like 12, 13 years old. If I was at the restaurant with my mom and dad and the server didn't come over and pour water after we'd been gone dry for like 5 minutes, I'd just get up and walk into the kitchen and like grab a pitcher and walk out. And I'm really impatient, and I get angry. I get angry about things that I view as deliberately slow and sloppy. So for me, and that anger can be harnessed sometimes into really productive aggression, but it's also, it wears you down at both ends. And so what I found is, after meditating consistently for even a week or so, when that anger would start, I was better at observing Tim as a third person, right? Like, look at that. Like, Tim's getting angry about something really small and stupid, as opposed to simply becoming angry and then causing problems for myself, whether it's just internal or interacting with other people. So, I agree with you completely on the meditation. And certainly,
I love that image of you as a 12-year-old racing into the kitchen, bring out the water. It's such a great metaphor for your life.
Yeah.
You find different examples of this in the process. You race in there and you get the water and you slice right through. I love it.
Let's do a couple of rapid fire questions that are all tied into this stuff, but we can just do short questions with a couple of short answers. So complete the following statement. My favorite time of day is blank. What is your favorite time of day, in other words?
My favorite time of day is holding my son in my arms after I've woken up, I've done a 20-30 minute journaling session. I get my son, I bring him downstairs and I give him his bottle of milk and I hold him and I look him in the eye and I tell him how proud I am. And we talk about what he's thinking about and what he's working on while he has his milk. And I think it's the most magical part of my day these days.
That's in the morning?
Yeah, that's that. I wake up about half an hour before him. I do a big creative burst. This is a big, you know, as a parent, your sleep patterns change, you know, pretty dramatically. But I found this rhythm where I wake up and I do that burst, and I just love that first morning energy time with him. And we have this deep connection while he's having his milk. And
love it. What time do you wake up?
Talk about things. I usually wake up around 7:05.
I'm endlessly fascinated by morning routines, so this might seem really digging into the minutiae, but when you wake up, it sounded like you wake up and you have 30 minutes to journal before bringing your son downstairs. Do you brush your teeth, drink a cup of coffee, any of that before you journal, or do you just roll out of bed, walk into the office, and sit down to write?
My routine is that I roll out of bed, I brush my teeth, I go downstairs, and I sit down with my journal, and I start writing. And I immediately apply myself to a reflection that I'd sort of targeted my mind at in the evening or late afternoon before. And then I just let it rip. I have a big creative surge. And then once I hear my son, I go get him, and then I have my breakfast, usually a bowl of oatmeal, while he has his, you know, after he has his milk, and then I have a cup of coffee about half an hour after that.
Cool. Related to, you strike me as a happy guy. Obviously, we all have our challenges then and again, the place I'm getting remodeled at the moment, which I won't go into diatribe at the moment. I'm very excited about it, but it's my 12-year-old Tim wanting to go get the water pitcher that's not being very helpful right now. What are three things? Could be three things that you believe you need in order to be happy. And that could be for you, could be for people in general. I'm just curious how you would think of that question or answer that question.
One of the great things about you and I being dear friends and having these conversations is that you tend to be very good at thinking in bullets and lists of three things, and that's just not how my brain works. And I can tell you the essence of how I relate to that question.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give you a three bullet answer because that's just not how this brain operates. I've built a lifestyle around being true to myself. Mm-hmm. Largely, maybe a big reason is because of, you know, my mom used to always tell me as a kid to follow my heart, follow my dreams. I never made decisions for money or for external things. And I always trusted if I was true to myself, these things would follow. And so, you know, my professional life, my foundation, my school, I only work with people who I feel are ethically aligned, who have a good energy, who I feel really good about intuitively. I keep empty space in my life. I rarely have more than one or two meetings a day. My life is about quality and not quantity. It's about depth and not breadth. My business is based on doing very, very deep and very excellent work with just a handful of people. And so I really like to cultivate quality as a way of life. And I believe that when you're not cultivating quality, you're essentially cultivating sloppiness. And so,
right.
You know, the idea of building the musculature of quality and being like a heat-seeking missile for me. And I take great pleasure in observing the beauty of the little moments in life.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, my lifestyle is based on, you know, I'm working out every day. I just focus on structuring a day that will allow for my creative process to be rich. I'm present with my son. I have my office is at home. I'm with him in the morning. I'm with him. I see him throughout the day. I'm with him. I give him his bath and read him his story at night. I'm with him. I've eliminated almost all travel that takes me away from my boy. I'm going to a conference this weekend. I'm taking my wife and my baby are coming with me. And I really build a life around being true, and I don't build it around anything material. And that's really the essence of how I personally relate to this question. Of course, there's different solutions for everybody, but
this
works for me.
This is something that is being true to oneself, I think, that most people struggle with, right? And I think it's a goal that most people have, at least in the abstract. But I'd love to dig into some concrete details of that, and perhaps you could share an example of something you changed, like maybe where you got slightly off the path and made a correction to be true to yourself, and what that looked like.
Well, I mean, for me, a very clear example is my public life. So I was a young kid, fell in love with chess. When I was, I won my first national championship when I was late 8, early 9. When I was 11, a book came out, Searching for Roy Fisher. And then when I was 15, a movie came out about my life, based on the same book that my dad initially wrote. And so I was really thrust into the spotlight. And so I, without me wanting to, I was just, a young, passionate artist. I loved playing chess and competing in chess. I was put out there, and I had paparazzi following me everywhere. I was, I was really living in the spotlight in a way I wasn't necessarily emotionally prepared for. And I felt in my teens how that challenged my love for this art, because my love for it was so pure initially. And that tension, that fight to stay true to my art, taught me some very deep lessons. And then after I finished high school, I took off and I left the country largely to study chess very deeply, undistracted from publicity. I moved to Eastern Europe. My girlfriend at the time was from Slovenia. No one knew me out there, and it was a beautiful life. And I just left the public world. And since then, when I came back, I've had these periods where I've been exposed to publicity, and I've been periods where I've been, deep in a cave and moved away from it. And I think that this is a very clean example of other than you, very few people drag me out of the public eye.
Throw a net over the bear and drag him out of the cave.
You have a way of doing that to me. But in a beautiful way. And I've found that the privacy of my life, not doing things, not getting caught up in the swirl of fame or seeking external adulation, is a very important thing for me personally. And everyone's different, but for me, maybe I have a little bit of an oversensitivity to this because of my youth, because I was out there so intensely as a young guy, and I think it really challenged my love for the game. This is an example of the kind of decision that I'll make. I think it's very important for me to live the vast majority of my life privately. I don't do very much that will allow me to be recognized in the street and live my life as a celebrity. Because I've gone down that path, and I love my privacy.
Yeah.
And I also have built, a career around my business is working with people who are similar, who are not seeking the limelight, who are not out there on television every day, who are world class, but are no one around them, other than people, very close, have any idea that they have been so incredibly successful from a monetary way. They try to raise their kids, not to be spoiled. The kids are gritty kids. They're great philanthropists, really good people. I'm very drawn to people who have been enormously successful, but don't get caught up in the external crap that comes with success. And are real, who are living their life tapped into the love. And that's how I try to live.
What are the books, let's just stick with books for a second, that you've either most gifted to other people or most recommended to other people? Because there are many people listening to this probably who won't necessarily have the opportunity to interact with the types of high-level folks that you and I are so fortunate to have the chance to interact with. But they can do that vis-a-vis books or narratives, documentaries, right, et cetera. What are some books that have had a formative impact on you?
So if we go back to when I was 17, 18, Jack Kerouac had a huge impact on my life. On the Road, Dharma Bums. These are the, his books were what initially kind of tapped me into the idea that life could be ecstatically beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I moved into studying Taoism, so Lao Tzu, mm-hmm. the Tao Te Ching, hugely, just unbelievably deep. But of course, the translation of that book that you read will be formative. And my favorite translation is the Jia Fu Feng and Jane English translation of mm-hmm. the Tao Te Ching. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, I think one of the most important books ever written by Robert Persig, who has become a very dear friend over the years. When The Art of Learning came out, my publisher asked me, who would you love to read this book? And I said, well, the one person I'd really want to read that book is Robert Persig. But to me, that was just, he lived like a deeply secluded life.
Mm-hmm.
But they somehow managed to get him a copy of the book he got in a big bushel from his publisher, and he read it, and he contacted me and wrote. I mean, I was so honored that he was moved by it. And he and I, and over the years, have developed really interesting dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance is one of the most important books in the world that focus on quality, dynamic quality, finding art in, learning to find art in anything.
Mm-hmm.
Deeply, deeply brilliant philosophical book. Shantaram, one of the most beautiful novels I've ever read. Gregory David Roberts, also someone I've gotten to know very well. Just an ecstatically beautiful, beautiful book. And, of course, I'm also a lover of fiction. I mean, Hemingway has been, he's probably the most important writer of my life.
Any particular novel stand out for you of his?
I mean, I think that For Whom the Bell Tolls, just mm-hmm. exquisite novel. Green Hills of Africa, amazing. His short stories are utterly magnificent. I think Green Hills of Africa is one of the most underrated books that he's written.
Mm-hmm.
His complete collection of short stories, I mean, there's one magnificent gem after the next. Of course, Old Man and the Sea is one everyone thinks about, and it's a fantastic, beautiful book. I guess if I had to have a favorite, it would be For Whom the Bell Tolls.
For Whom the Bell Tolls. Yeah, for those people listening who also want insight into his writing style, A Movable Feast is...
magnificent book. Yes.
Yeah, also really...
And that's where Hemingway really speaks to his writing process.
Yeah.
Fantastic book.
So fascinating.
There's a great book, by the way, Tim. I think you've read, which is, I think it's Hemingway on Writing.
Yeah, I did read it. Yep, I also read that. Yeah,
if someone wants to get to know Hemingway, it's just a fantastic compilation of all of Hemingway's writing in letters, in his books, in his articles, everywhere, put together thematically, basically Hemingway on the writing process. I think it's one of the most important little collections of on creativity that I've ever run into. Absolutely brilliant book.
And it's really short. I remember I read it on Kindle on a short flight that I had, and just like jammed right through the whole thing. One of the recommendations was Write Drunk, Edit Sober, and I realized that Write Drunk, Edit Sober does not translate to podcasts very well. The last podcast that I did with my buddy Kevin Rose, if you record drunk and try to edit sober, it doesn't really actually work the same way. Oh man, and we'll just do a couple more questions because this has been fun. But if you had to run out of your house and just take a handful of things with you, obviously your family is safe, so that's accounted for. What would you take and why?
In what kind of situation?
In
a very dangerous situation?
You don't have to fend for yourself with weaponry or create fire with flint or anything like that. There's a fire in your house. You just have to get out to the street, and then you're going to obviously sort things out later. But assuming your family is safe, what would you take with you? Just what you can carry, basically.
That's a really great question. I actually had that experience years ago when I was playing chess, and it speaks to how crazy I was. I was studying chess with this brilliant Russian grandmaster named Yuri Razavayev, who actually wrote about my book. And I was on the fifth floor of a walk-up. This was an old one-bedroom I had in my first apartment. And there was, suddenly we were deep into chess study, and there was a huge fire. And I looked out, there were like five fire engines and dudes screaming at us, and we had to go out the fire escape, and I ended up going back in and grabbing my computer with all of my chess analysis, which is just a random thing to do. It was so unimportant. I mean, it speaks to how different I've become. Yeah, and then ended up being, we had been seconds from being an updraft and blowing the whole building up. Yeah, so I wouldn't do that. I don't know, man. I think I might, honestly, when you ask me that question now, if I think that my family was safe, I have nothing material that I would grab.
That's great, man. That's a very stoic response in the most positive way. All right, my man. I'm going to ask you one more, and I'll give you a choice of two questions. Yeah, let's do that.
All right, let's do it.
So the first option is, what did you want to be when you grew up? So when you were a kid, and what now? How would you answer the question? What do you want to be when you grow up? That's question number one. Question number two is, if you had a committee of three people, living or dead, to help you make decisions, who would you choose and why?
These are great questions, man.
Thanks. By the way, I'm borrowing liberally from like every good interviewer I've ever come in contact with. But so it goes.
You want me to answer them both, or you want me to answer one of them?
You can answer them both.
Two very different questions. I mean, this is tough, man.
Yeah, I mean, if they, I'm just trying to be respectful of your time. But if you have time and you have some thoughts on both, let's go for it.
When I grew up, I wanted to be a professional baseball player. I loved. So there was something about sport. So I think that there was a. I mean, and I spent a lot of my life as a competitor from age basically six until, 30. Five, I was basically a professional competitor in
yep.
the field. Today, but my mom always said to me that she felt like that was a phase and that I was a healer. That was always her language. And a lot of what I do today is try to figure out how to help people express themselves in as pure a way as possible, artistically, in a way that gives them joy. I mean, I think that my plan is sometime in the next 4 or 5 years, I'm 37 now. I'm thinking about it when I'm 40, 41. I guess that'd be 3-4 years now. I'm getting old. to turn my mind to everything, taking everything I've been doing in these different laboratories and apply it to a world-changing education initiative.
Yeah.
Helping children in a just fulfill themselves in a very deep way, I think, is a central calling, which I'm not going to say it's my end game, but that's the next major chapter, I think, of my life that I'm building towards. I've been running my foundation for many years now, and we do beautiful work, but I have an allergy to scaling if it's going to dilute quality in any way. And so I've been sort of building up the foundation, like the groundwork to ultimately be able to do something hugely important in education. So I think that's going to be the core of how I'm building towards that in a few years. In terms of the committee of three people,
just to interject for a second, that's also, I think, my calling. And of course we've spoken at length about this. So if you need a co-conspirator, count me in for that one. Certainly.
Yeah, dude, let's plan on this. Let's say 4 or 5, we have to figure out when it's going to be. Maybe 4 or 5 years, we'll team up and we'll take the world by storm. I think that's a great plan.
Sounds like a plan, man.
I love it.
So committee. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I think this sort of taps that movement away from self. I mean, as a competitor, you're constantly fighting, and in many ways, there's something about the focus inward on oneself. And in becoming a parent, I've definitely felt this movement away from that. I mean, my son is just, my love for him just so transcends anything I ever felt before. It's been really, really important to experience. When you become a dad, man, then we're gonna have some fun.
I can't wait.
Look forward to your sleepless nights.
Oh man, yeah, you're gonna see battle weary Timbo. I need to work on my polyphasic sleep. This is a committee of three people. What are your thoughts?
Well, one person who would be on that committee is someone who I know, very deep friend of mine who happens to be in the finance world. His name is Dave. I can't speak about what his last name is. Just a deeply meditative spirit, great wisdom, as insightful a human being as I've ever known in my life. And I think that he would definitely be on that list. Mm-hmm. I mean, can I say outrageous characters like Gandhi?
Yeah. Go for it. Yeah.
I mean, I think about Gandhi, Lao Tzu, the Buddha. I mean, my God, what a but you see, these there's a certain I don't know, man. I don't know if I can answer this question very intelligently.
That's the perfect way to end.
Yeah. I don't know. And Tim, of course, you, man. I mean, you give me so much crap in life. I'd have to call you because you'd be the one just to keep. You'd definitely be the one to slice through all the nonsense. Yeah. And my mom. That's the most important one. My mom.
Yeah.
She's given me the most deep advice in my life. I mean, my mom is the one person who has really embraced these crazy decisions that I've made when I've left arts, when I was at the tops of their field, of those fields, and because of some strange calling I had inside. I think my mom would have to be the top of any list like that. She's my hero. My mom's the greatest person I've ever known in my life.
Awesome, man. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Obviously, we're going to have a lot more conversations. Is there anything you want to, any parting thoughts, advice, suggestions, anything like that that you'd like to impart? If not, we can call it a day, but the mic is yours if you have anything you'd like to add.
No, I love this. It's been really interesting. I mean, I guess if I'm going to close with a thought, it would be that, you know, one thing that I've been doing in the last years, since writing The Art of Learning, is I've been exposed to some of the most brilliant thinkers in these different fields. And I've studied the patterns behind them, and I've studied the people who study them. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we have to be wary of in life is studying the people who study the artist as opposed to the artist themselves.
Right.
Persig, who the author of Zen, the Art of Cycle Maintenance that I mentioned, he uses this great term of the philosophers and the philosophologists, right? The philosophologists are the ones who are basically philosophizing about the philosophers as opposed to doing philosophy. And the vast majority of philosophers today actually are just philosophologists. Similarly, as you know, you and I have discussed, there's the writers and the literary critic. There's the artist and the art critic. And I think that we have to be very careful when we study excellence and we're thinking about our own path to excellence, that we're studying and we're tuning in to the direct experience of people who have actually been there, as opposed to the armchair professors who are talking about it.
Right.
Because, you know, if we spend our life in the trenches and we spend our life studying that last 0.1% of the learning process, what we see is that final passage to excellence is really about navigating that razor's edge, where you have to be willing to go right up against a potential enormous blunder. You have to improvise, for example, trust your intuition in moments where all the objective mathematical faculties you've developed are telling you something else, but your intuition is operating at a higher level. You have to really be willing to go up to the brink of disaster to succeed, you know, in moments where you're, for example, fighting in the finals of a world championship or in the very last seconds of a Super Bowl or an NBA finals. And in navigating these things, the armchair professors will often have the exact opposite of good advice.
Right.
And so what I would say is for one thing, you know, listen deeply internally to the core of your being and build your game plan from there. Trust your gut. And then build a lifestyle around listening to that and cultivate the love. And that's the other thing I'd say, is that whether you're talking about the beginning of the learning process or the very final surge or surges, it's about the love. Think about parenting, cultivating resilience, cultivating excellence, cultivating creativity. What the armchair professors all forget about is the love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I see consistently with people who have found the most pleasure, the most happiness, and created the greatest art, is that they have a profound passion for what they do. Not only the big moments, but the little moments, the moments that others would call pain. They learn to love practice. They learn to love the point of resistance. I don't forget about the love. I guess that's what I'd like to say.
That's a beautiful way to end this, man. Well, Josh, I'm sure we will be talking. Next time we'll have some wine. And Yeah, I hope everybody checks out, obviously, The Art of Learning and really keeps an eye on what you have coming when you decide to push stuff out of the cave. So,
thanks,
all right, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.
This has been an unabridged audio production of The Art of Learning by Josh Waitzkin. Produced by Audio Evolution, LLC. Engineering and post-production by Pete Pantelis. Recorded at Merlin Studios, New York City. Copyright 2007 by Josh Waitzkin, LLC. Production copyright 2008 by Josh Waitzkin, LLC. All rights reserved. If you are interested in learning more about Josh Waitzkin or his educational foundation, please visit joshwaitzkin.com.